You know, Hogan looks good on his knees. I've seen him on his knees in two or three occasions, and he looks good like that.
It's business time, baby.
The Solid Monster sounds off.
It's such good shit.
Mama Monster
conquered a street.
You like fighting a woman?
Oh my God, we're only an hour in. We have two more hours of this.
Come over here and fight me.
Fight me. You even been beat up properly.
Woo! Poor Stephanie McMahon. Her dream of WWE becoming, and I quote, as big or bigger than Disney, grew dimmer this week with the news that its Disney Plus streaming service did 10 million signups in its very first day. It's all I've been hearing about all week. People on social media have been tweeting about it. Boy Meets World reruns. This thing, The Mandalorian. I don't even know what the fuck a Mandalorian is. Is it a DeLorean that can only be driven by men? I have no idea. I think I saw a trailer for it. I might have seen a trailer for it. For whatever reason, it kind of reminded me of The Rocketeer. Unless I just watched something completely different. I know I'm dating myself now by mentioning The Rocketeer. Nobody else will, so I may as well date myself. But I mean, is it like that? I feel like I'm way off here. Anyway, Stephanie is very upset they could not come to terms with The Mandalorian to put him on the WWE Network. Now the only way to make her dreams come true, I guess, is to go to Disneyland. That's about the only shot she has of that becoming a reality. This is episode 626 of the Solid Monster Sounds Off here for Sunday, November 17, 2019. I am the Solid Monster. If you missed the clip that I put up on the YouTube channel this past week, if you remember last week, I answered a mailbag question talking about my favorite sound off moments over the past 12 years, my favorite episode, all that kind of stuff. It was a segment that got a lot of positive feedback. And I decided to, when I put that clip up on YouTube, include photos and video from a lot of the moments and the interviews that I talked about. And it really turned out nice. I'm proud of that video. I look back on it. I watched it again the other day, and it's pretty cool. All the things that I have been able to do here vis-a-vis this show. So anyway, if you want to see the added photos and video, you can check that clip. It's up on the YouTube channel right now. There were a few people asking about, I just want to mention this quickly, the ExpressVPN thing I mentioned from last week when I did the ad for them. I've been using the service the past several weeks. I've had no issues yet. It's worked out fine for me. It helps mask you online. VPNs generally, I think, from my experience, are good to use. You know, we have a VPN set up at work, for example, for our office, so that I can remote in off-site when I'm not at my desk. In this case, what we're promoting is the sports package, so that you can watch all of the NFL games that you want, regardless of what city you live in. It's pretty cool. It's pretty cool. So anyway, if you missed it, you can use our link, expressvpn.com/solomonster. If you're going to sign up and try it out, it's not a bad deal if you want to watch a lot of football. And there's still a lot of football left to be played this season. Using our link, of course. Using our link, of course. It's also a great way to show them the power of the Sound Off audience. So that's the link that you can use. Anyway, let's get into the roll call here because we've got a ton of shit to get into. So much stuff to talk about this week. I almost want to cry. But it's happy tears. Tears of joy. And I want to talk about the House of Glory show last night. But first, if you would like to become a PayPal VIP, first of all, thank you. You may do so on thesolemonster.com, right-hand side of the page. You will see the button to donate. You could always use the email as well if that's easier. thesolemonster@gmail.com is the email address you can use to donate as well. Thank you to the Portland pop star, Paul Hamilton, John Loose Cannon Lopez, Deadpool James Herrera, the Florida Freebird Brian Becerra, Out of Control Cody Thomas, Beast Mode Brock Joseph, Killshot Keith Hart, Stephen Handyman Halistick, Velvet Revolver Robert Murray, Josh the Shooter Stockton, the Chicago Slayer Willie Eichard, and from the Chicago Slayer we have the Chicago Screamer Ian Noel Camelotes, the Diamond Dallas Dance Machine, Harrison Soep, the Carolina Panther, Bradley Gooch, who turns 28 tomorrow, so happy birthday, happy early birthday to Bradley. Lightning Kevin Forte down in Barbados. He's listening to the podcast right now. He's also sending a special shout out to his mom today, Ms. Cave, who turned 61. And today also would have been his aunt's 59th birthday. She passed away a few years ago, so he's thinking about them both on this day. And hey, Logan, if Logan is listening, thank you for the iTunes review. Very much appreciated. You also put us over the top with 1,000 ratings on iTunes now for the show, which is awesome. So thank you for that. The Wise Men Wrestling Podcast. It's three grown men with bagel bites, ginger ale, and hot takes on pro wrestling and everything in between. It is available anywhere you listen to podcasts, courtesy of Anchor.fm. And listeners can interact with them via voicemail at anchor.fm/wisemen-wrestling-podcast or on Twitter at @WeAreTheWiseMen. This week's show will be covering the many appearances of the Rock and Roll Express. They'll have their own review of the HOG show in Queens, CM Punk's, quote, return, and ACH's exit. And the Wise Men Wrestling Podcast reminds you that you vote with your dollars, and even if you're a mark, make sure to leave a mark on this life. And shout out to Montesi, Antoine Moore. You can hear his song Take Flight for Sammy Guevara on AEW Dynamite. Let me play a little cut of the song for you here. Sammy Guevara, it's my time just to take flight. Put it on the line, all in the same night. It's a good tune. He and Sammy are hoping they get to perform the song live one of these days. Maybe on TNT, maybe on pay-per-view. Hey, maybe Antoine can join the inner circle. If you like the song, you want to support Antoine, he's good people. You can buy the song. It's just 99 cents on Google Play Music if you search for Montesi Take Flight or on Apple Music. House of Glory held its No Limit show last night from the NYC Arena in Jamaica, Queens. A show honoring the late Matt Travis, who passed away tragically last weekend at the age of 25. Terrible accident. Awful thing that happened. Should never have happened. And obviously, as you could expect, it was a very emotional night. A lot of people in that building were very close with Matt. Knew him from when he was even younger, coming up in the wrestling business. They were friends of his. They worked with him. They knew him outside the ring. They knew how dedicated he was. He ate wrestling. He slept it. Everything was pro wrestling with him. And he was on the ascent. And no doubt he was factored into bigger plans in the future for House of Glory to, I'm sure, build around. And so last night was in tribute to Matt. And I think it's a show he would have been very proud of. There was a big meet and greet also before the show. A lot of big names just kind of milling around the show. Kurt Angle was there. I think Tugboat showed up. We had Mark Henry announced only a few hours before the show that he was going to be there making an appearance. I saw Enzo talking to people off in the corner. A lot of different people. Victoria was there. And anyway, the show had a very emotional speech made at the very beginning by the Amazing Red, who, you know, runs the HOG school and was part of House of Glory for so many years. And he even said in his speech, you know, Matt Travis was like a son to him. He helped train him. He worked with him. And his biggest regret is that the two of them had a falling out over something very stupid and very trivial in the grand scheme of things, and hadn't spoken since April of this year. And so when he got the news, he felt very badly because, you know, the last they had spoken was so long ago, and things kind of ended there on a sour note. And you can hear it in his voice. I mean, he was just ripped up inside. It was awful to hear him talk about that. But he just spilled his guts last night, and it was good to hear from him, as close as he was to him. Tommy Dreamer, another one who announced only a few hours before the show, hey, I'm coming to the HOG show, and I'm bringing some friends with me, he said. Now, Dreamer ended up wrestling on the card. He inserted himself into a singles match, turned it into a three-way dance. He did not win. JT Dunn did. Then we had Low-Ki and Leroy Green in a Street Fighter battle on the Nintendo Switch. Yes, you heard me right. And I hope that by the time many of you listen to this, that it's up on YouTube or clips of it are up on the YouTube, the HOG YouTube channel, because it would be crazy for them not to get this up. There was a match scheduled between Low Ki, who has wrestled many times before in HOG, and as the story goes, he was being brought in, brought back to House of Glory by Charles Mason, the suicidal six-way champion, to destroy Leroy Green. Leroy Green, you may have heard the name before. He's done some work more recently with Evolve. Young guy, big video gamer. And that's what he does. He comes to the ring. He's got his Nintendo Switch. He sits down cross-legged and he plays video games. And I know it's a very polarizing gimmick. It's just like Orange Cassidy or Joey Ryan or any number of wrestling. Marco Stunt. Everybody, there's all these polarizing personalities. You either really love him or you really hate him. And I feel like now Leroy is starting to fall into that category, which is great for him because it gets him more attention. But Charles Mason decided to bring in Low Ki because he hates this kid so much he wants to see him dead. He wants to just see his career ended, and that was why he brought Low Ki in. And the visual of Low Ki standing in the ring, being handed a Switch or a Switch controller, and on the two screens that we've got in the arena, they synced up the Switches so you can watch them play against each other. One was Ryu, the other was Chun-Li, and the people went nuts. And I'm sitting there with JD, and we are calling a Street Fighter battle between Low Ki and Leroy Green. Just the visual of Low Ki in his usual gear, the white shirt, the tie, as serious as he normally is, playing a fucking video game. If this shit doesn't go viral, then I don't know what will. It was awesome. It actually was a really fun moment to see Low Ki out of his usual element. And then as soon as it was over and he lost the video game, I think he lost the video game battle. I was all wrapped up in it. I don't even know who won and who lost. I believe he lost. And he didn't take it very well. And then we got to see the real Low Ki, and he killed this kid in about 60 seconds. So you kind of got the best of both worlds, right? If you wanted to see Low Ki the killer, you got that. But you also got to see him play some Street Fighter for a few minutes. So you might be seeing footage of that floating around online. It was a great moment. And maybe our commentary will be laid out over it because we were going crazy for this thing here. TJP, they brought TJP in. He challenged Montekia. He became the new Crown Jewel champion. So we're going to be seeing more of TJP in HOG. He's so good. He's so good. You almost forget because, you know, TJ Perkins in WWE, he won the Cruiserweight Classic. He became the Cruiserweight champion. He got a little push there for a while. And then, as is the case with a lot of these guys, because there's just so many freaking people in WWE, you kind of end up fading into obscurity. Unless you're one of the tippy-top guys, you end up fading into obscurity. And that's what happened with TJP his last few years in WWE. And you sort of, you almost forget how good he really is. So good in the ring. And in the main event, it was a three-way tag team match involving The Circus, Midas, and Jay Lyon. And the New York Wrecking Crew, and team number three, the Rock and Roll Express. The Rock and Roll Express were brought in for a meet and greet appearance. They shot an angle in the back and put a video up on the screen in the middle of the show that inserted them into the main event. So that's how they got them in there. And I got to call my first Rock and Roll Express match. Maybe my only Rock and Roll Express match. How cool is that? How cool is that? I mean, It's cool because I've had the chance to call a lot of really great matches, a lot of cool moments like that in the 2 years plus I've been working with HOG. So, you know, LAX and Private Party and the Young Bucks, got to call the Young Bucks last indie match a few months ago. And then out comes Ricky and Robert, 63 and 64 years old, I think. And they're out there in their gear and everyone's chanting rock and roll and Ricky Morton's on the apron trying to get the crowd into it and people are going crazy and it's like, This is incredible to be ringside and watch all of this. And yes, Ricky Morton, for those interested, did bust out a Canadian Destroyer. He didn't win with it, but he busted out a Canadian Destroyer. Robert actually got the pin, so the Rock and Roll Express won the match. But yes, Ricky Morton at 63 years old. It took a couple of tries, but he did get the Canadian Destroyer and he nailed it. They got beat down by the Wrecking Crew when the match was over, and Tommy Dreamer comes out to try to stop them. He gets beat down. Mikey Whipwreck comes out. He gets beat down. And then finally, out comes the Dudley Boys. Bubba Ray and D-Von, together for the first time in, it has to be years, right? I think the last time we got some kind of Dudley's reunion in WWE, it wasn't like a Royal Rumble or something, but it was D-Von and Spike, because Bubba was under contract, I think, to Ring of Honor or something. It's been years since we've had a proper Dudley Boys reunion. We got it last night, and they hit the 3D, and Bubba hit the Bubba Bomb. You know, D-Von's been working as an agent for WWE. So he was there last night. Huge pop. Everybody ate it up. And, you know, afterwards, Dreamer called out Brian XL, who runs House of Glory, to make a speech. And during his speech, yeah, he was giving praise to everybody in the ring, all the ECW crew and Mikey Whipwreck for training so many of the people now that you see, you know, on the independent scene in wrestling. And all the contributions that he's made, and the Dudleys and Dreamer, and what Dreamer's done for a lot of people. And he made mention at one point, he mentioned All Elite Wrestling, and he said, you know, you look at how AEW is changing the business, and I swear, if D-Von was as white as Bubba is, you would see the color drain from his face when he made that comment. So, like, D-Von, he's like laughing, he drops his head, he pretends he's going to leave the ring, he says, well, I guess I'm fired now. And but anyway, it was great. You know, obviously he talked about Matt Travis. Dreamer ended the show. He got the last word in by talking about Matt Travis. And then the entire roster came and filled up the ring and came out to pay tribute to him. His family, I know Matt's family was in the crowd. I think they did the man proud. I really think they did a hell of a job paying tribute to him last night. He should have been there last night. He should have been there wrestling. But he will not soon be forgotten. It was also great to link up with Chris Van Vliet. He was in the house last night. He was over at the big event nearby and said, why not stop by and check out the HOG show? And we had a great conversation, not for his channel, but hopefully we'll link up next time we're in the same place together and do an interview. I know we've been meaning to do that for a while. The next show is December 7th. December 7th, back at the NYC Arena, special appearance by the Nature Boy, Ric Flair. This will be his second appearance for House of Glory. And there's a lot of big plans for 2020. A lot of big plans I can't discuss, but some very exciting things are going to be happening real soon. CM Punk made his first WWE-affiliated appearance on the WWE Backstage show. He walked out as a surprise at the very end on Tuesday night, and you know, the internet went crazy about Punk being back, and half the people seemed to love it, half the people seemed to hate his guts. A lot of divided. There's another one of those polarizing personalities in wrestling, although I think he's more well-liked than not. That's my sense of it. But anyway, I did put a Sound Off Extra up talking about the whole Punk situation, where I think this is going, my feelings and my thoughts on how it was done. I did not put the audio up. It was exclusive to YouTube. And what I'm going to do now is, for those who did not hear it, and I know there were a lot of people who did not, who asked about this, I am going to insert the audio now into the show. I am going to play my CM Punk update. For those of you who do not care about CM Punk, or if you already heard it, you want to skip ahead, it runs about 25 or 26 minutes. So just a heads up for those people. But this is the Sound Off Extra update on CM Punk back in the fold, kind of. Sort of, with WWE. Check it out. Solomonster here with a special Sound Off Extra update for November 13, 2019. I just wrapped up my AEW Dynamite stream, which you could listen to every Wednesday live here on the YouTube channel. And I figured, you know, I've got the microphone already hooked up, and I've already been getting emails with all of the questions about this, so why not talk about something else that happened in the last 24 hours, that being the return of this CM Punk guy on WWE Backstage. So I'm sure everybody by now has heard about what happened just the other night. WWE Backstage, it's the studio show on FS1. They have Renee Young and they have Samoa Joe as their guest analyst and Booker T and Paige. This week they had Adam Cole, the NXT champion, in studio with them. And at the very end of the show, as they're getting ready to go off the air, Renee Young, who apparently was the only one in the know, they kept this a secret from everybody else on the set. Nobody else knew this was about to happen. Renee was the only one who knew. And Renee Young says, you know, in WWE, you like to make epic moments and we've got one here and now, and all of a sudden we hear Cult of Personality, and out walks CM Punk. Punk walks out, and he walks over to the set where everybody is standing. He walks over to the camera. He looks into the camera. He says, "When they think they have all the answers, I change the culture." And he says he'll see everybody next week. He gives Renee a big high five, and they cut off. Right then and there, they go off the air. Talk about an underwhelming return after nearly 6 years away from doing anything publicly with pro wrestling. Forget the indie shows where he put a mask on, like he's fucking Evil Uno from AEW or something, sneaking around, doing little indie shots. This is the first time in almost 6 years that this man has done anything even remotely connected on television to pro wrestling. And he walks out on set, no live audience, just walks out. "Hi, guys." This is not the return that most people envisioned, I don't think, for CM Punk. But, hey, they gave him his old music at least. It was good to hear Cult of Personality again. And here was something else I thought was cool. Samoa Joe, who's out, he's been nursing a thumb injury. I have no idea how much longer he's going to be out for. I don't know if he had surgery or he's got a cast on his thumb. Anyway, that's why you haven't seen Samoa Joe. Samoa Joe is there, and he's standing within a few feet of Punk. In the background, big smile on his face. And you think of the history these two guys have, going back to their Ring of Honor days. I don't know when the last time the two of them even spoke or interacted or saw each other. I thought that was pretty cool, seeing them next to each other like that. I thought it was very smart to save him for the very end of the show like that. And now we're going to find out. Now we are going to find out what kind of drawing power the name CM Punk actually has here in 2019, at least in studio. I know it's not the same thing. It's not in the ring. He's not walking out in front of an arena, you know, full of 10,000 people. It's not the same thing, but they have now teased the return of CM Punk to WWE programming. You gotta tune in next week. I'm gonna be here next week, guys. Tune in. See you then. We're gonna find out how much of a draw he really still is all these years later. I think this is a good first test for what kind of appetite there is for people to want to tune in and see CM Punk. You never know what he might say. Are they gonna interview him? Maybe they'll take a few minutes and they'll do an interview with him. There's a lot of people out there, very casual fans who may have been CM Punk fans, who maybe they know that he did some fighting, but they don't keep up with what he's been doing. Is there a curiosity factor there? Are there a ton of people who all of a sudden are going to tune in at 11 o'clock next Tuesday to see CM Punk? We're going to find out. Fox was very swift in putting a press release out saying Phil Brooks, better known as CM Punk, joins WWE backstage as a special contributor and analyst. He will make select appearances in studio alongside Renee Young and analyst Booker T. So Punk's going to be popping up on backstage, not every week. He will not be on the show every week, but he is now officially a part of the show. Before I get to the rest of the Punk stuff, I want to talk about here, they made some other announcements on backstage last night. They announced the signing, the multi-year signings of The Miz and Paige, who have signed new multi-year contracts with WWE. It's very odd to me since Miz just signed a new multi-year deal last year. It was in February of last year. He signed what was said at the time to be a new four-year contract. And now here he is signing another new deal, I guess that supersedes the old deal that he signed. So he's pretty much going to be a WWE lifer. This new deal, said to be 6 years, is going to take him through the year 2025. So The Miz is pretty much a lifer in that company, which I think most people figured. I mean, why would The Miz leave? For God's sakes, I mean, look, this company has given this guy everything. He met his wife. He's got two kids, making good money. He's making WWE films, movies. And all things considered, when you think about it, I know he's not hot right now on TV, but he's had a pretty good career. World champion, headlined to WrestleMania, beat John Cena, Intercontinental champion multiple times, United States champion, tag team champion. Not a bad run. Not a bad run at all. He's built a Hall of Fame, a WWE Hall of Fame career for himself. So why would he leave? Then you got Paige. Paige is interesting in that she signed a new deal, a four-year deal. It's going to keep her with the company through the year 2023. And that tells me that she is resigned to not wrestling again. You know, you have to think that if she had the itch, like I'm sure Daniel Bryan had, and Daniel Bryan, I fully believe, was ready to bounce at the end of his contract and go work somewhere else, and we would have seen him in Mexico, we would have seen him in New Japan, you know, maybe we would have seen him back in ROH. He eats, sleeps, and breathes pro wrestling. But once he got an inkling of the fact that he might be able to come back, you know, he's stuck with WWE. Paige has been told outright, you're not going to be cleared. You're not going to be medically cleared. We will not clear you. You will not wrestle. If she wanted to wrestle that bad, she could have let her contract run down and gone and wrestled somewhere else. So she seems resigned to putting that behind her. And you know what? If her condition is such that she shouldn't be in the ring, then good for her. I don't want to see her in the ring. I don't want to see her all crippled up. This woman's got scoliosis on top of everything else. So she's going to be sticking around for a while. The other news, and I have not yet seen NXT tonight, so from what I understand, Finn Balor now has a new opponent for Survivor Series, but the original plans for Survivor Series weekend, I should say, the NXT TakeOver show that weekend, the original plan was for Finn Balor to wrestle Johnny Gargano. Well, Johnny Gargano was out. Speaking of injuries, he is out of NXT TakeOver War Games due to a neck injury, the severity of which has not been revealed. I don't know if it's bad enough that he's going to need neck surgery. I hope for his sake that's not the case, because if it is, he's going to be out for a while. But all we've been told is that he has a neck injury. And, you know, that would explain why we really have not seen much of him on television now for the last couple of months. So that frees Balor up for a new opponent, who I will not name for those who have not yet watched NXT. And who knows, you know, maybe it frees up Balor to do more than just wrestle on the TakeOver show that weekend. You know, he's not going to be busy at Survivor Series. Maybe he gets involved in one of those matches. Maybe he can help give Team NXT a win in the men's Survivor Series match, or maybe he comes out during the Triple Threat. AJ Styles, Roderick Strong, Shinsuke Nakamura. You know, the OC maybe thinks he's there to help him out, and instead he costs AJ the match. Although that probably is the match that I hope does not end with some kind of outside interference, because that would be very disappointing. Back to CM Punk. This was not a big surprise. We already knew that he had auditioned for the role. This was hardly a secret. Punk openly talked about it. He did interviews admitting his agent came to him. He went to California, to LA. He did the audition. He didn't know how it went. This was public knowledge. And I've seen a lot of people back and forth, a lot of people arguing, yelling at each other. He's not with WWE, he's with Fox. Other people saying, well, it's all the same thing. And then just it degenerates into these horrible arguments online. He's working for Fox. He is not technically working for WWE. That is true. PW Insider confirmed. It is a Fox deal only, at least for now. This is how it starts. WWE did give their blessing for them to add him to the show. And why wouldn't they? Why wouldn't they? This is a show, this WWE backstage. This is a show that did less than 50,000 viewers last week. They did not even chart in the top 150 shows on all of cable last Tuesday. Now, there was a college basketball show of some kind that aired before backstage last week that did 17,000 viewers. So by comparison, the 49,000 that WWE did last week was an improvement. But when was the last time that a WWE show had an overnight viewership of less than 50,000 people? It's mind-boggling. Even on a network like FS1, maybe it's not as widely available as USA. So what? It's almost incomprehensible that a WWE show would have viewership that low. Now, the deal with Punk was apparently finalized in just the last few days. He auditioned last month, but the deal wasn't done until a few days ago. No shit. You don't say. Of course it was. Of course it was. Are you kidding me? They couldn't agree to a deal fast enough when those numbers came in last week. 49,000. They could not ink, the ink on the contract could not dry quick enough for the executives at Fox to get CM Punk. Now, what does this mean for a potential return to WWE? Nobody can say for sure. The only person who knows that is CM Punk. Only CM Punk knows. If CM Punk wants to come back to WWE, believe me, Vince McMahon and Triple H, even though Triple H, I'm sure on a personal level, I mean, you can't tell me that Triple H loves this guy, but they know how to do business, and you can't tell me that if Punk wanted to come back to WWE, he would not be welcomed back with open arms. So the ball's in his court. I do think it is inevitable that CM Punk will be back in a ring with WWE at some point, just not anytime soon. There will be no WrestleMania 36 match. So I think people need to pump the brakes on this idea that, oh, he's back and he's going to be on Raw or he's going to be, you know, Fox is going to want him on SmackDown. I'm sure they would. But this idea that in a month or two or three, Punk is going to be back and they're going to set up his program at the Royal Rumble for WrestleMania, I don't see it. But I do see this as being step one. He will be back. And I think you need to consider a few things. Number one, Punk has been very public about the fact that the past isn't in the past. Especially, he did this interview last month with Collider, which was actually a very good interview. He's very open. He was very honest. He was in studio for about an hour or so with these guys. And his attitude seemed to be almost like Brett 12 years after Montreal. All that bad blood, I'll never go back. These people fucked me. They screwed me. And he came back. He let bygones be bygones. And that was the vibe I got from Punk in that Collider interview. So I don't want to say he's been more complimentary of WWE. I mean, these are the people that he feels, you know, didn't give a shit about him and mistreated him, fired him on his wedding day. Believe me, there's still a lot of bad blood underneath. But he seems to have softened recently. Now you couple that with the fact, WWE, look at the state of WWE right now. And I know it's easy for me to sit here and say, forget the fact that they're getting billions from USA and Fox, and forget the fact they're getting millions of dollars from the Saudi prince. They are. They're actually making quite a bit of money off those deals. Now, if those deals were to go away, they'd be in a lot of trouble. But it's not anything they're going to have to worry about in the next few years. They've got a lot of money coming in mainly from those two things, the TV deals and the Saudi deal. However, one fact remains. WWE continues to lose viewers year after year. They are hemorrhaging viewers. People are giving up on Monday Night Raw. They're giving up on SmackDown. I think it's more a Raw problem. Now that they're on Fox, the SmackDown viewership is actually higher than Raw on most weeks, which is something that you would have expected because Fox is network TV, USA is not. So you're going to have a wider pool of people who can watch your show. But people are giving up. And I'm hearing from them. Now, this is, you know, just a small part of the audience, but I can just speak for myself. You want to use me and my show as a sample size, and I'm sure other podcasters and YouTubers would say the same thing. I constantly get emails and tweets from people saying, I only keep up with WWE or even just wrestling in general. I mean, some people won't even bother with AEW or NWA or anything else. They've just given up, and they only keep up with what's going on through the Sound Off and through other shows. It's gotten to the point with a lot of people, they are more entertained on most weeks by listening to people like me, schmucks like me, and other people, than actually watching the shows. Now, I'm grateful, but even I think, hey, you know what? There's something wrong here. That just doesn't feel right. Now, why is this happening? It's happening more and more and more. So yeah, you can keep making all the money you want to off these TV deals, but at what cost? Long term, they're doing a lot of damage with these shows. And they're still waiting on that next big star to come along and save them. So they rely more and more and more in the meantime on big names and star power from the past. And not just for sweet Saudi money cash grabs. You've got Hulk Hogan and Ric Flair and Steve Austin. I feel like I've seen these guys on my TV more than I did during the Monday Night War in the last few months. If you don't think that WWE wouldn't make a play for CM Punk, who has said, when asked, what would it take to get you back in the ring, he has said, a big bag. He's been very honest. A big bag is what it would take to get me back in the ring. You don't think, as they continue to lose viewers, that they wouldn't make a play to bring CM Punk back to television? You know they're only one horrendous rating away from picking up that phone and calling over to Chicago. This is no different than the Ultimate Warrior or Bill Goldberg signing their own deals with 2K independent of WWE. That's how it all started. Those deals paved the way for them to make nice and get back together with WWE. It started with 2K. This will end up being no different. Fox is the conduit through which WWE and CM Punk, ultimately, however many more months it may take, are going to make up, they're going to make nice, and whether it's full-time, part-time, one match, WrestleMania, I think he said he would never go to Saudi Arabia, so we'll put that on the side, but it has paved the way for CM Punk to make his eventual return to the ring. Now, if that were to happen, because I know I'm going to get questions about this, so I'm trying to proactively answer some of these questions. When you ask about, well, what match, what CM Punk match is there that would be considered a dream match? What CM Punk match is there that really gets you excited? When you look up and down the roster in WWE, what match, what potential opponent for Punk gets you excited? I'll be honest with you, right now, there is none. There is no one big dream match in WWE for CM Punk. I'm sure him against some of the guys on that roster, and especially in NXT, would have very good matches together. But Punk's been out of the ring for 6 years almost. So who's to say that you would get the same CM Punk that you remember from 2013 and 2012 and 2014? But when I look up and down the Raw roster and I look up and down the SmackDown roster, I mean, my God, there's nothing that really jumps out at me that says, oh boy, I can't wait to see that match. Seth Rollins went on Twitter, or so I'm told because I can't see, but Seth Rollins went on Twitter and said, CM Punk, fight me. Fight me. Fight me. Thinks he's fucking Aleister Black now, this guy. I don't care about seeing Seth Rollins against CM Punk. Why? Because they were together in NXT that one time? Who cares? Who gives a shit? That match doesn't excite me. Punk and Daniel Bryan? That would be cool to see one more time. But I would hardly call it some kind of dream match. We've already seen it. Punk and Samoa Joe? That might be it for me. That might be the Again, there's no dream match. But in terms of a match that would appeal to me, Punk and Joe, that might be it for me. And I know it's not the same Samoa Joe of old. He's dealing with a lot more injuries. He's heavier. It's not the same. Not the same CM Punk and Samoa Joe that were together in ROH. But with their history, I think that can make for a fun build. And you've got two guys here who know how to talk. You put a microphone in their hand and it's fucking gold. Punk and AJ Styles, that's kind of interesting to me. Styles came in after Punk had already left, 2 years later. You know, there was supposedly heat between the two of them at one time, years before they came to WWE. This is going back to like the early to mid-2000s. And I think, I could be wrong, I don't know the full background here, but I think it may have stemmed from some stuff that Punk said about AJ in a promo that he did in Ring of Honor. It actually might have been the night that he signed his WWE contract in Ring of Honor. He may have made some disparaging comments that AJ Styles was not very happy about. Whatever it is, whatever the source of the heat is, was, you know, maybe now they're cool, who knows. I'm sure they would be willing to do business together if they were asked to. But if you ask me, well, what's the dream match? The dream match was very simple. The dream match was very easy. The dream match was with Stone Cold Steve Austin after the build to the video game and that sit-down interview for 2K13 that they did with Jim Ross. which had nothing to do with WWE. That was all 2K, and I think Paul Heyman helped out with that shoot. But that had nothing to do, ironically, with WWE. It was a non-WWE production that got me the most interested in seeing a match that I never had any chance of actually seeing. That was the dream match, and that ship sailed long ago. Actually, that ship never even left the dock. It never even left port. Austin was never coming back. He has been playing games for years whenever people ask him about it. He was never coming back. It's easy now to look back and see. He was never coming back. So that ship never even left the dock. Speaking of dock, that may be the match I'm looking forward to the most if he ever does come back. CM Punk against Dr. Amon. First one to climb the ladder and pull down the Z-Pack wins. And feels better. But just to wrap up the Punk stuff, my question would be, and the real curiosity that I have, what kind of drawing power, if any, does CM Punk have left after 6 years away? 6 years gone from WWE, 6 years away from television, the defeats that he suffered in UFC. And yeah, you know, you can look at it and say, boy, you know, he had some balls to go in there and get his face caved in. He had more balls than most people would have. Well, yeah, I wouldn't go into the octagon and get my face pounded in. Although if you flashed $1 million check in my face, I probably would. I could take part of that money and get my face fixed. But hey, you know, he had a dream he wanted to pursue. And it was, you know, he put the effort in, he put the work in, he trained, and it didn't work out. Frankly, it was kind of embarrassing. What effect is that going to have? Is it going to have any effect at all? Are people going to even remember the fact that he got mangled in his UFC fights? With some people, it will. It will affect their perception of him. Although I really don't think that's going to end up being much of a big deal. I can remember a time when Jonathan Coachman was on ESPN talking about when Ronda Rousey lost for the first time. And then talking about if she ever goes to WWE, she's got no credibility and she lost. And, you know, the guy's a freaking clown. Of course, it had no effect whatsoever on her WWE run. So you could say that maybe it won't affect Punk. But what kind of drawing power is left 6 years later? Does anybody care? Clearly, some people do. Clearly, I mean, look at his name has been trending all day. People have been talking nonstop about this guy, and not just overnight. For years, they chant his name at the buildings, less so now, but for years they would chant CM Punk. The guy didn't want to have anything to do with wrestling, and they would still chant his name. So yes, there is a segment of the audience that actually gives a shit about CM Punk. My question is, how big? How big of an audience sample is it? And we're going to get a sense of that next week when the ratings come in for next week's show. And you can bet your ass Fox is not just going to be watching. WWE, Vince McMahon, they're going to be watching too. But as things get more dire and their numbers continue to drop, it's only a matter of time before somebody picks up the phone and makes that phone call. And if they're willing to pay the money, I think Punk is willing to listen. And if he's willing to listen, it's only a matter of time before he makes his way back to the ring. But for now, he's a Fox employee, and he gets to come on TV and talk about WWE, which I find fascinating because I believe there was an interview he did where he said he doesn't even watch wrestling. So yeah, he's going to be an analyst on this WWE show, but he doesn't watch WWE. I suspect that will now change, and it's kind of like Eric Bischoff when they brought him in to lead SmackDown. That didn't last very long. I don't get the sense that Bischoff was watching WWE week to week. He had to go through the whole learning process and get all caught up on storylines and creative and who the people were. I don't think there'll be as much of a learning curve for Punk. He already knows some of these people. He was friends with some of them. But yeah, if he hasn't been paying attention to wrestling too much, he's going to have to get all caught up. And we'll see. We'll see what kind of drawing power, if any, he's got left. But that's the update on CM Punk. I'm sure we'll be... A lot will be said by a lot of different shows about him in the coming weeks. But yes, he is a Fox employee right now and not WWE. Keywords, for now. 4 years after WWE announced that Stone Cold Steve Austin would be sitting down with The Undertaker and other big names like Sting and Hulk Hogan as part of his WWE Network podcast series, which never happened, by the way. I mean, the series did, but some of those interviews never happened. He is finally going to be sitting down across from the table with the Dead Men himself for what they are calling a long-form interview as part of a new monthly series hosted by Austin called The Broken Skull Sessions. And this was part of the original announcement. WWE announced that its new monthly series, Stone Cold Steve Austin, The Broken Skull Sessions, will begin streaming on WWE Network immediately following Survivor Series on Sunday, November 24. At approximately 11 p.m. Eastern, oh God, I hope it is, because that means that they'll keep Survivor Series no later than 11 o'clock. That word, approximately, though, that worries me. Approximately can give you a lot of leeway. That means Survivor Series could end at 11, it could end at 10:55, it could go to 11:30. Hopefully earlier than not, so I don't have to start streaming at midnight that night. But hosted and produced by Stone Cold, the series will feature no-holds-barred one-on-one conversations with the biggest names in WWE history, including legends, superstars, and celebrity guests. For the premiere episode, Austin welcomes The Undertaker, Mark Calloway, for a rare long-form interview with one of the most prolific and enduring superstars of all time, filmed at Austin's home studio in Southern California. Each episode, I'm surprised it's, well, maybe it is. Is it in Los Angeles, isn't that what he says, right? That's what he calls it. Los Angeles, California. Each episode of the Broken Skull Sessions will contain more than an hour of engaging, candid conversation with guests. And so, even though that says more than an hour, the trailer that they posted for this online, which has about 30 seconds or so of footage, calls it an unprecedented two-hour event. So maybe it's somewhere in between. Maybe they're breaking it up into two parts, which would be kind of smart. I mean, think about it. The Undertaker has been around for about 50,000 years, right? In this company. I mean, he is an undead zombie, so maybe he has been around for that long. He's got, I'm sure this guy's got hours and hours and hours of stories to tell. And so the idea that they would maybe film 2 hours and break it up into two episodes, get two episodes. I mean, shit, get three episodes out of it. Make a whole anthology series out of it. And that way you get people coming back for 2 weeks in a row, 3 weeks in a row. I don't know if that's what they're doing. That's what I would do. Just break it up and keep people coming back. You want to boost subscribers to your network, that's what I would do. But I don't know if it's 2 hours or not. I'm still looking for confirmation on that. We know it's going to be at least an hour. And WWE Network, you know, the reason I can't check is because WWE Network no longer allows you to search their schedule by day. You can only look at that day's schedule, unless I'm missing something, at least in the version that I'm using. You used to be able to skip ahead by a few days, maybe a week, see what the schedule was going to be. Now you can't do that. So I can't even look on their website and see how long they've blocked out for the show next Sunday. But Undertaker has been making himself, it feels like he's been making himself more available for interviews like this than he has in the past. He did that one sit-down with, what was his name, Pastor Ed Young, at whatever church he's affiliated with, which was probably the most insightful interview that he's ever given on a personal level, in terms of getting to know more about him on a personal level, beyond just pro wrestling. You know, he opened up about his faith and how his wife started taking him to church with her, and now he goes to church every week. He's got to atone for tying Stone Cold to that cross all those years ago, which WWE used to argue it's not a cross, it's a symbol. As if that wasn't the symbolism they were going for. I mean, that's all semantics now. Yes, technically it was not a cross, it was a symbol, but give me a fucking break. You know, it's like the Goldust thing. Remember when Goldust was like 2002, 2003? That Howard Stern interview that he gave. This is when WWE used to let some of its talent go on Howard Stern. Hell, Vince McMahon went on Howard Stern. Stephanie McMahon went on Howard Stern and was talking about the kind of sex that she liked having with Triple H, which I won't get into here for all the kiddies that may be listening. It's amazing. It's like the tale of two companies, like some of the things they used to do. But anyway, Goldust was on with Stern at one point. And this was after Evolution attacked him and electrocuted him. They threw him on Raw into that electrical panel and sparks flew, and it was this whole big angle that they shot. And so Goldust would start randomly shouting things out like he had Tourette's syndrome. But in this interview, he was adamant. They would say, oh, so you got Tourette's. And he's like, no, it's not Tourette's. It's a neurological condition. Like, sure it is. Okay. Sure. It's all a matter of semantics. So I, for one, hope that The Undertaker apologizes to Stone Cold, not only for that, but for trying to embalm him alive. The Attitude Era, man, I'm telling you, it was crazy. It was crazy time, and not always in a good way. I hated Ministry Undertaker, by the way. Cool music, I thought his theme was badass. There were elements that were cool. And I did like the first blood match that he and Austin had at Fully Loaded. Jim Ross's favorite pay-per-view, so much so that he said as much on Wednesday on Dynamite. Full Gear be damned, it's now Fully Loaded. But yeah, I was not a fan of the Ministry Undertaker character. Undertaker is probably the one guy outside of Vince McMahon who I would love to see write a book on his career. And the McMahon one I would trust about as much as I trust the Hogan one for accuracy. But being able to watch these two on video, shooting the shit back and forth, that should be a lot of fun. So I was thinking about this and I said, you know, if the shoe was on the other foot and it wasn't Austin doing the interview, let's say that Austin was run down by a car, again, by Rikishi, and they chose me to do the interview. Now, why they would do this, I have no idea. But let's just play along with me here. So what are some of the questions that I would ask The Undertaker if I had the chance to sit down and get the, it's like the holy grail of wrestling interviews. If I had the chance to sit down with The Undertaker, here's a sampling of some of the questions that I would like to ask him. It's pretty well known that The Undertaker likes his whiskey. I believe he's a Jack Daniels guy. Smart man. And there's stories, I mean, there's tons of stories, but there's stories about, remember Wrestler's Court, you hear about that. You don't hear about that anymore. Wrestling seems so boring now. It seems so sanitized. You don't hear about Wrestler's Court and all these stories. But back in the day, you would hear about that. Undertaker would be either the judge or he would play some other role in Wrestler's Court. And you would hear stories and read stories online about people buying him like a bottle of Jack as a way to ingratiate themselves with him and kiss his ass, basically. A bottle of Jack for The Undertaker. Bottle of Jack for The Undertaker. You'd hear about people get, you know, a little cognac for Booker T. If Chris Jericho was there, it would no doubt be Grey Goose. Forget the bubbly. I hope to one day meet a young lady who looks at me the way that Chris Jericho looks at a bottle of Grey Goose vodka. So I would ask him about his whiskey preferences. See, someone has to ask these tough questions. Here's another one. Why are you so afraid of cucumbers? Yes, The Undertaker is said to be terrified of cucumbers. So are cats, by the way. Which only means one thing. The Undertaker is, in fact, a cat. Or Mark Calloway, I guess. It would be more appropriate to say Mark Calloway. The Undertaker is afraid of nothing other than Father Time. Mark Calloway, he doesn't like cucumbers. Paul Bearer talked about it. Many years ago, he did an RF shoot interview with Jim Cornette. He can't stand them. He said, The Undertaker, can't stand them. He can't be around them. He said, pickles are fine. He's fine with pickles. And I'm the same way, by the way. I love pickles. Can't stand cucumbers. But I'm not as bad as The Undertaker apparently is with them, where I can't be in the same vicinity with cucumbers. Paul said that he used to take cucumbers and he would put them in Undertaker's hat before they went out for a match. He would slip them into his gloves. He would torture this man. There was one time he said he saw The Undertaker throw up all over the place at a Waffle House. And really, I could just cut the sentence off right there and say no more. I mean, Waffle House is hardly gourmet dining. But he threw up at a Waffle House when he spotted a cucumber floating in his iced tea. I think it might have been Owen Hart who pranked him. Bruce Pritchard on his podcast also talked about this. So I would ask the question, why? Where does this hatred and this fear of cucumbers stem from? Did your mother make you eat them as a child against your will? Is that why The Undertaker killed his parents? Because they made him eat fucking cucumbers? You know, was it an old girlfriend who was a little too kinky in bed and did unspeakable things to you with a cucumber? We deserve to know the truth. Asking the tough questions. So with all the fluff out of the way, I would get down to brass tacks, get a little more serious. I would ask, how close did he really come to jumping ship to WCW? You know, Eric Bischoff has said that there were never any serious conversations with Mark Calloway. Kevin Nash says something very different. Kevin Nash has done shoots, and he said that they were very close. It was around the time that The Undertaker became the American Badass in WWE. He had been out for many months with an injury. He was unhappy with the direction of his character. Nash could be right by that timeline, because how would Bischoff even know he lost power in WCW during that period when this would have happened? So who's telling the truth? How close did Undertaker, if at all, ever come to jumping ship to WCW? I would talk about that loyalty that he's had to the company for so many years. And why? When so many other people went elsewhere, why did he not do the same thing? What was his beef with DDP when he came to WWE? Because he buried the shit out of that guy. I would be curious to know. The streak. Was there ever a time where he wanted to do the honors for someone and he was turned down? He was rejected by Vince McMahon. And of course, I'd have to ask about the match with Brock Lesnar, WrestleMania 30. You know, Vince McMahon, when he did the Stone Cold podcast, he said that The Undertaker wanted to do the right thing. And it was funny because Stone Cold didn't seem to buy what he was saying. He was like, wait a minute, you mean to tell me that this was The Undertaker's decision? And then eventually Vince finally confessed and said, well, you know, it was my call, but, you know, he went along with it because he's a company guy and he's always willing to do the right thing. And you know, there may have been some resistance on The Undertaker's part to lose that night. Or maybe he just didn't see it as the end of his career. And Vince McMahon said that he looked at it a different way and this could be it for him. Maybe that was where the disagreement stemmed from. I would want him to, and I would be shocked if this doesn't happen on the Austin show. I would want him to take us through that day and take us through the decision to end the streak. And if he had to be convinced to do it. And would he have, if it were up to him, would he have broken the streak? Or would the streak have just gone on indefinitely and he would have retired undefeated at WrestleMania? And then, and I do think that there is a respectful way to ask this question. And I think it's a fair one. And I'd like to think that I would ask it without having to worry about him pummeling me into the ground. I would play him a clip, if I could, of what he said in that famous Michael Landsberg interview when they were up in Canada for WrestleMania 18 weekend or week, whatever, in 2002, where Undertaker was talking about the old guard, even older than him at the time, people like Hogan and Flair, and his desire to not overstay his welcome and tarnish his legacy, in effect, in so many words, what he was saying is, I don't want to be like those guys. I want to know when the time is right for me to slip out and slip away so that people don't look at me the way they look at some of those guys and think, man, I wish this guy would have called it quits 5 years ago or 10 years ago. What's this guy doing? He's embarrassing himself out there. I would ask him the very simple question. What changed? So those would be some of the questions that, serious and non-serious, that I would ask the Undertaker in a sit-down interview. I'm looking forward to seeing it. Austin, I think, is great in this environment. It's not going to be live, so maybe it will, you know, maybe it'll be a little more laid back. Hopefully the complete opposite of that disaster of a Dean Ambrose interview. And it's no big surprise. And I had so many people arguing with me at the time about, oh, well, there was nothing wrong with the interview, Salamos. And coincidentally, I don't believe there's been a single Stone Cold podcast interview since the one with Dean Ambrose on the WWE Network. That is not by accident. There's a very good reason for it. I suspect this will be a much better interview. Before I get to Raw and SmackDown, and then we have news on not one but two WWE stars asking for their release this past week, and another one quitting the company, or trying to anyway. But before that, sad tweet this week goes to Pete Dunne for a tweet that he posted 1 year ago. This is the first time that I believe I've ever awarded sad tweet honors to someone for a year-old tweet. But it'll be clear why in a second. On November 27th, 2018, in the face of mounting criticism at the time online about how WWE was harming the UK independent wrestling scene and how the end of the UK wrestling boom was coming and being, at the very least, if not caused by WWE, because I don't think it's fair to blame a lot of these promotions that are going belly up all on WWE. Some of it, frankly, is their own doing. But at the very least, their demise being hastened by WWE. In the face of all of this, Pete Dunne stood up for the company that he worked for and posted this tweet. British wrestling is safe. We'll continue to grow. The talent pool is deep. Your favorite wrestlers are achieving goals and taking steps in their career. Don't believe everything you read. Brit Rez is alive and well. And while I would agree that they have a deep talent pool, even still in the UK, and it's great to see Pete Dunne and others achieving their goals, and I know Pete Dunne just recently moved stateside here, and we're going to be seeing him more on TV and in NXT, this tweet did not age well. This week came the news that IPW UK will be closing its doors at the end of this year. This is a promotion that was founded 15 years ago. It's been around a long time. And they had their own issues. I don't think it would be, again, fair to say that you can just blame WWE, their UK expansion, for this. Although no doubt it did hurt them. I mean, how could it not? But there were also issues with the previous owner. You know, they probably should have changed their name after that because of that. If what I've read about those issues is accurate, they probably should have changed their name. But this makes at least four UK promotions by my count. There could be more. Four promotions this year alone since that Pete Dunne tweet that have shut down or announced plans to shut down. Defiant Wrestling, the former What Culture Pro Wrestling, they were shuttered in August. Southside Wrestling ran its final show last month. Pro Wrestling Chaos, they announced a few months ago that their final show is going to be taking place in February of next year. And the owners made it very clear in this video they did, that I watched, that there were a lot of different reasons for them closing down that actually had nothing at all to do with WWE in their case, or at least that's what they claim. Because they were actually still doing very good business. But they outlined all the different reasons why this was a decision that had to be made. But here's the thing about this, right? Whether you blame WWE or not, whether you blame WWE for snatching up all the good UK talent and for forming alliances with some groups and not others, which is going to hurt those groups, regardless of whether or not that applies in every case here, you know, if WWE partners with, I mean, ICW, but doesn't partner with some other organization or ends their affiliation with them, that's going to hurt. That's going to sting. Because all of a sudden, you no longer have access to use all these different talents that you had access to in the past. So this is very much a real thing. This is the WWE effect, and it's had a chilling effect on some organizations over in the UK. No doubt. No doubt about it. And the people who live in the UK listening to this right now can speak to this even better than I can. But it's obvious that it was going to have an impact, and it has hurt a lot of people, okay? There's no doubt about that. But the idea that British wrestling is fine and all is well, nothing to see here, like Baghdad Bob. Remember Baghdad Bob from the Iraq War? You know, oh, the minister of misinformation, they called him. Nothing to see here, everything's fine, until all of a sudden we didn't see Baghdad Bob anymore, because Baghdad Bob probably, you know, got blown up. In retrospect, that tweet sounds even worse. When in the 12 months since, it's not even a full year yet, it's just about, in the 12 months since then, you've got at least four promotions closing down. And there could be one or two more that I'm not even thinking of on a smaller scale. But these, I think, seem to be the biggest of the bunch. That's not good. That is not good for British wrestling. Speaking of the UK, Raw, this past Monday, was in Manchester, England. Twitter poll, over 3,200 votes. 16% thumbs up, 84% thumbs down. Well-deserved for one of the worst shows all year. And it was the show, it was a show of the worst kind. It wasn't good, but it also wasn't so bad it's good. where you can at least be entertained by it in a train wreck kind of way. It was just bad. Just a miserable 3 hours, on the whole, a miserable 3 hours of television. And yes, the Lana and Rusev segment is a big part of that, but it's not the only reason. This show has no life. It has no pulse. This show is a zombie. It is a rotting corpse. AMC should have its attorneys send USA Network a cease and desist and explain to them that The Walking Dead is an AMC property, not USA. That is the state of Monday Night Raw. One of the only positive things that I can say about this show, lest anybody think that I have nothing positive to say, and this is more of a general statement, is that the Kabuki Warriors are being featured more than any other team thus far to hold those women's tag team titles. Because when the Iconics had them, or even Nikki and Alexa to some degree, I don't think you were seeing them on television every week. You really weren't seeing the titles defended all that much. When the Iconics had them, it was completely non-existent. Sasha and Bayley, they said, oh, they showed up in NXT that time and, you know, teased that they would defend the belts there, and they never did. Of course, they didn't have them for very long. And so the women's tag team titles all of a sudden are being featured more and defended more on television more now than at any other point in their existence. And I know it made no sense to have Becky Lynch in there with Charlotte when it was Charlotte and Natty who beat Asuka and Kairi the week before. But they said Natty had a personal family matter to tend to and she couldn't, you know, go on the tour, or maybe she got sent home early. I don't know what the issue was with her, but she wasn't there because of a personal issue. Okay, that's what they said. So then don't do the match. Save it for when Natty comes back. She's already back. She's having a singles match with Asuka tomorrow night on Raw. But I like that Asuka and Kairi are actually on TV every week. And they're defending the titles, and I've enjoyed their heel run so far. And Asuka and the Green Mist, I like that. And with Asuka pinning Becky Lynch in this match on Monday last week, they may finally be ready. I won't hold my breath on this, but they could possibly finally be ready to revisit their feud and bring up the fact that Becky Lynch tapped out to Asuka at the Royal Rumble before Becky won the championship. They've had that in their back pocket now for almost an entire year. They had to revisit that at some point, and hopefully they will, but, you know, Asuka's part of a tag team right now, so are they really going to pluck her out of that while she's still in a tag team and put her in a serious feud for the women's championship with Becky Lynch? I can't see that. But they should. And that is where my praise comes to a screeching halt. I thought the 24/7 stuff on this show with R-Truth and the Singh brothers was stupid. And it goes to the point I made last week. How uninspired and just lazy and uncreative it is. It's the same shit every single week. I cannot fathom that there are people out there over the age of 10 who are actually still entertained by this. It's like Groundhog Day every week. At least change it up. No creativity whatsoever. And then we get to the Lana segment. Lana comes out and she confesses that she was 9 weeks pregnant. And it had to be Rusev's little machka brat because she only had sex with Bob Lashley for the first time 7 weeks ago. So the Cliff Notes version of this is that it was all a setup to get Rusev to come out. Lana lays the trap. Lashley then comes down and beats up Rusev, and then when they go back on the stage, Lana reveals that she was never really pregnant at all. It was all a ruse. Let me say this about that segment. A lot's been said, I'm sure, this week about that segment. I don't know what other people said, but I'm sure it wasn't very nice. I'm going to give you my impressions of this segment. I think what amazed me the most is that this was a taped show. This was not live. This was a taped show, taped days in advance. This was a show that they could have watched back in the truck or wherever at their lair, their cave in Stamford. They could have watched this segment back and said, we can't put this on the air. This is horrible. Let's edit something else into the show. Of course, they don't think this is horrible. That's not how they think. They think this is genuinely good shit. It's such good shit. It's not just a meme. It's the fucking truth. I could hear his voice in my head right now. He was probably cackling in the back when the segment was over. Such good shit. I could hear his voice in my head right now. Remember that Boogeyman Halloween stream they put up on the WWE YouTube channel a few weeks ago? Inexplicably, they just had Boogeyman sitting at a desk with a bunch of toys and trinkets on it for 3 hours. It was just a live stream that popped up on their YouTube channel of the Boogeyman sitting there and doing nothing. 3 hours of this shit. They would have been better off airing that entire stream of the Boogeyman in place of this entire show. They had the chance to pull this segment so that it would never see the light of day, and they aired it anyway. There was nothing they could do to edit out how much this segment sucked, because it did suck, and the storyline sucks. Everything about it sucks. Not if you ask Rusev, it doesn't. He's out there giving interviews saying that it's the hottest storyline going today. Because it gets 10 million views, I guess, on YouTube. It's the hottest thing going. Everybody loves it. Now, maybe he's being sarcastic when he says these things or when he tweets these things. He's a very sarcastic guy. This was a print interview. I can't hear his voice. I can't tell if he's actually being serious about this. I assume he is. If he honestly believes that, just because the videos get millions of views on the YouTube channel, they sure as shit don't get many millions of views on TV. But because they get millions of views on YouTube, that it's the best storyline going and it's just hot stuff, then you know what? I think then that there's something to be said for not letting the talent book their own angles. Let us hope they never let Rusev sit in on those booking meetings the way that Vince McMahon used to let Triple H sit in on those production meetings. Now, on a taped show, they tinker with the crowd reactions. This is hardly breaking news or any kind of new phenomenon. I mean, sometimes they'll tinker with the crowd reactions on the live shows, too. Like when they used to noticeably turn down the crowd volume. When Roman Reigns would come out and get booed out of the building. When it was really at its peak, when Roman was just getting booed real bad every single week. You can notice when they would turn the volume down on the crowd when he would make his entrance. So even when they're live, they could tinker with the crowd reactions. But sweetening the crowd noise on a taped show is hardly some new practice. You go back and watch those old superstars and challenge shows from the 80s, all the syndicated shows. They sweeten the crowds all the time. We just didn't notice it as much because in my case, for instance, I was six. But they've done this for years. They manipulate the crowd reactions to suit their own agenda. It's a television show and they want their television show to go exactly the way that they want it to. You know things have gotten bad for Seth Rollins when WWE resorts to manipulating the crowd reactions for his segments, as they did on this show. Multiple reports from the taping said that when Rollins came out, he was greeted by a mixed reaction at best, and when he made the comment during his promo before Walter came out about thinking that he is the best wrestler on the planet, he was roundly booed. But you would never know it, because on TV, he was cheered. Just like magic. The Rowan backstage segment, Eric Rowan, the segment with the Singh brothers, I don't believe was even shown to the live crowd, which makes the piped-in crowd noise even more ridiculous. You know, one person on Twitter even said they spliced in some crowd shots from the October 28th Monday Night Raw in St. Louis, Missouri. He knows this because he spotted his friend in the crowd holding up a sign. And his friend definitely does not live in Manchester. Rollins did wrestle Walter on this show, making his Raw debut. They were in the UK, so he was there with Imperium. The two of them had a match. It was nothing special. It ended in a DQ, led to Imperium losing to Rollins, Kevin Owens, and the Street Profits. It was nice at least to see Kevin Owens coming out and getting a big reaction. After barely being on television for the past month, that was nice to see. Aleister Black, he's still sitting in a room waiting for somebody to pick a fight with him, or pick his nose, or do something, anything. Fight me! Fight me! Now, he hurt his knee recently. He tweaked his knee. I don't think it's anything serious, but he did hurt his knee. So, I would assume the reason they still have him sitting around waiting for somebody to fight him is because he's still healing up his knee. But maybe not. Maybe they are completely devoid of ideas, Because even before he tweaked his knee, what was he doing? He was sitting in a fucking room waiting for somebody to come fight him. Well, guess what? Somebody did come fight him. His name was Cesaro. And they had a match. They had a couple of matches maybe. And then it was right back to the room. Right back to the dark room. Because they have no ideas. They don't know what to do with him. He would be better off being kept off television completely until he's ready to come back, because he is turning into a punchline with this. Randy Orton, Ricochet, and Humberto Carrillo beat AJ Styles. Ricky Mort, What the hell's wrong with me? I think I need to upgrade my firmware. Luke Gallows, there we go. Luke Gallows and Karl Anderson, Jesus. They're teasing a match or a feud now with Orton and Ricochet. He teased giving Ricochet an RKO, but he gave one to AJ instead. That led to Carrillo hitting a moonsault and pinning Styles. Finally, after all these losses that he's racked up now in recent weeks, he gets a win here on the show. Orton and Ricochet is something, at least, it's a fresh match. They're on the same Survivor Series team, so maybe Orton gets eliminated. Maybe he snaps and he lays out Ricochet there. It just seems like they are setting up for a feud post-Survivor Series, and why not shoot the angle at Survivor Series to get you to that point? The Viking Raiders, we know tomorrow night, are going to be defending the tag team titles on Raw against Zack Ryder and Curt Hawkins. This is the big match that they are promoting in advance of Raw tomorrow night. The Raw tag team title match with Curt Hawkins and Zack Ryder. Oh, I can see this is going to be another fun-filled episode of Monday Night Raw. Then we had SmackDown on Fox from Philadelphia. Twitter poll, over 2,200 votes. Last I checked, it's probably more than that by now. 33% thumbs up, 67% thumbs down. Only marginally better than Monday Night Raw. I was not home when SmackDown started, because now SmackDown is on Fridays. And on Friday nights, I'm not going to be glued to my TV watching SmackDown. So I wasn't home. I caught up with it later on. But I'm looking at my timeline. I'm out, I'm at the gym or wherever I was. And I'm looking at my Twitter timeline. And I see somebody in a giant dog costume. A bulldog costume, walking out to the ring. You could imagine my reaction. Then I got home, and I actually watched this shit. And it only proves my point from last week. But I want to amend what I said just a little bit. I made the comment that the Baron Corbin promo with the doggy poop bags was perfectly fine if you're 12 years old. I would like to amend that. First of all, I'd like to apologize to all the 12-year-olds out there. That's number one. Number two, I would like to amend that statement after this segment and lower that number down from 12 to 6. These segments are designed to appeal to 6-year-olds and were conceived of by a 6-year-old trapped inside the body of a 74-year-old man. Baron Corbin is carried to the ring on a throne, Macho King style. That's fine. He's joined by Dolph Ziggler and Bobby Roode. Tonight, the two of them will wrestle Chad Gable and Mustafa Ali to try to take their spots away from them in the Survivor Series elimination match, on the SmackDown Survivor Series team. And yes, he is officially back to being called Mustafa Ali. As you know, I never stopped calling him Mustafa Ali here on this podcast. It was a dumb thing to change to begin with. And so I am glad that they were convinced, because I'm sure it wasn't their fucking decision, they were convinced to change it back. I know Ali was really unhappy about that. Like, the name Mustafa had a personal connection to him, and he was very upset. And I wouldn't be surprised if it was just him lobbying. And eventually he got them to change their minds. Whatever the case, I'm glad it's back. So then we hear Roman Reigns' theme music, and out walks the Big Dog, which was a guy in a dog costume. He got into the ring, he kneeled down at Corbin's feet, and that was the entire segment. I will spare you all the witty dialogue that took place during this segment. All you need to know is the dog got into the ring, he kneeled down by Corbin, and they cut to commercial. The only redeeming thing about this was the dog barking noise that they managed to sync up to the beat of Roman Reigns' theme song. I thought that was mildly entertaining. But I am amazed. I have to say, I am truly amazed. This is 2 weeks in a row of these awful segments. I mean, that doesn't amaze me. I come to expect it by now. But what's amazing is that they would be doing these types of segments on the Fox show. The Fox show was going to be a more serious show, a more sports-centric show. They even have analysts now. They don't have analysts for Monday Night Raw. I guess I'm the analyst. They don't like analysts like me. But they now have their own analysts on FS1 to analyze this shit. I would compare it to analyzing a stool sample. Imagine CM Punk on Tuesday having to analyze this segment. Segments like this, segments like, what was it last year, Bobby Lashley and his sisters, or the Lashley-Lana Rusev stuff now that we're getting on Monday Night Raw. Segments like this, these are the types of segments that make me embarrassed to be a fan. I mean, for God's sakes, at least have Roman beat up the mascot. We never even got to see the furry guy get beat up. I'm not one for animal abuse, but in this case, I would have made an exception. We didn't even get to see that. So what was the point? To get heat on Baron Corbin. This is the best way you could think of to get heat on Baron Corbin? Sure, for the six-year-olds. And that's what these segments are designed for. And if that's what Fox expected, then hey, more power to them. But something tells me that Fox wasn't exactly buying in on segments that appeal to the six-year-old demographic. $1 billion. Fox paid $1 billion for 5 years of this shit. They paid $1 billion for a man dressed like the Burger King and a guy dressed like Cujo. And I said it a few weeks ago, I will say it again, the biggest swindle in television history. Shockingly, this was the lowest rated episode of SmackDown since they moved to Fox, forgetting that one FS1 show. Fewer people watch this show than any other SmackDown on Fox since they debuted on October 4th. 2.3 million viewers. It was the least watched show on network television on Friday night outside of that Fresh Off the Boat sitcom on ABC, which did slightly less for the half hour that it was on. 2.3 million. We are now officially in Monday Night Raw territory. A show that airs on USA Network. Raw airs on USA, and USA is available in many, many millions of homes, but it's not network television like Fox is. SmackDown on network TV is now doing no better than Monday Night Raw. And every time I see a segment like this, like the one that they opened this show with, I say, good. Good. It is well deserved. Gable and Ali did beat Roode and Ziggler to retain their spots on Team SmackDown at Survivor Series. Roman came out midway through the match, which is when the giant costume dog vanished. He disappeared. I guess somebody threw him a bone and off he went. Corbin was in the heels corner, so when Corbin tried to get involved, Roman hit him with the drive-by, hit him with a spear. Gable hit the Chaos Theory on Roode. Ali connected with the 450 Splash. They picked up the win. Nice win for the two of them. I still look at Gable in the ring and I weep. The Universal title. The Universal title is no longer red. The red monstrosity is no more. It is no longer the tomato title. It is now the blueberry belt. Blue is my favorite color, so that alone makes this an immediate upgrade. But no custom title for Bray. Other than the side plates. You would think with a character like The Fiend, they could maybe come up with something creative. Maybe they will. Maybe they just need more time. But right now, it's just the same belt, but with a blue strap instead of a red one. These titles can never hold a candle to the old belts. The Winged Eagle, the Big Eagle, Big Gold, even the Undisputed title. I wasn't a huge fan of it, but it had a certain elegance to it. Those look like real championships. These giant logo belts, they just can't match up. But I will say it is at least an upgrade from the red belt. Believe me, the colors of the belts are the least of their fucking problems. New Day and Revival. That ended with the Undisputed Era laying everybody out before being chased off by the practice squad of the SmackDown roster. Apollo Crews, Heath Slater, Lucha House Party. Seriously, why is it always the second and third string guys who run down to break these things up? Where are all the big names? These four NXT guys just invaded your show. They just laid your people out. This is the invading force. Roman Reigns can't be bothered to come out with them. Braun Strowman can't be bothered to come out with them. We had the NXT squad of Rhea Ripley, Tegan Nox, Dakota Kai, and Mia Yim looking fine after getting her nose broken on Wednesday against Sasha Banks, Nikki Cross, Carmella, and Dana Brooke. Nikki pinned Dana. She pinned Dakota, I guess, to earn her spot on Team SmackDown at Survivor Series. Rhea, I thought, looked great. She looked like she belonged in there with the main roster ladies. They all look good. I think aside from that one spot that was a little wonky, where Tegan and Dakota looked like they forgot who the legal person was. When Tegan, I think, went for the pin, the referee just refused to count the fall. Because they tell the refs, count, you know, call it like a shoot. And so that was kind of an awkward moment. But aside from that, I thought that they all looked good. NXT did lose, which, look, it's not Henny Penny, the sky is falling. You know, as long as they don't get swept at Survivor Series. NXT cannot be swept at Survivor Series. Miz TV ended the show. I love that even though they're positioned as babyfaces now, Daniel Bryan and The Miz still cannot stand one another. Bryan even said Miz TV sucks. He got some boos for saying that. I would actually say Bryan is more of a tweener. I don't even think I could call him a full-on babyface just yet. He kind of is, but he was acting very heelish here on this show. This segment was to set up the Survivor Series match. They are going to wrestle for the Universal Championship. It will be Bray Wyatt defending against Daniel Bryan. The Firefly Funhouse popped up, and they were going back and forth, and Bray was going through his toy chest. He pulled out the Universal title, the Blueberry Belt, and he asked Bryan to say that one magical word. He wanted him to say yes, and Bryan said no, and they went back and forth, and the puppets were all saying yes, and Bryan would say no. And Bryan said, look, if you want to fight, then let's fight. And he said, why not put the Universal Championship on the line? And Bray thought about it, and he chanted yes over and over and over and over again repeatedly to end the show. They went off the air about 3 minutes early. You can hear Daniel Bryan in the ring looking at Miz or looking at someone off camera going, is that it? Are we done? And then they played his music, and then he walked away. And that was how SmackDown ended on Friday night. They should be embarrassed. When they opened the show up the way they did, I thought they ended strong. I liked the Miz TV segment. And I am looking forward to the match between Bryan and Bray at Survivor Series because Bryan is the one guy who gave Bray Wyatt the best singles match of his entire career. Now, this is a very different character. The match is going to be worked, I'm sure, very differently. He may no-sell everything that Bryan does. I don't know exactly how the match is going to go. But it's a match that I'm looking forward to. But the way they opened this show and some of the promos and the verbiage and the dog poop stuff, this company should be ashamed for putting segments like this and the Rusev and Lana stuff on television. They should be ashamed. Of course, they are incapable of feeling shame because in this case, they think that this is good shit. And that's why you've got to speak up. You've got to speak up. You've got to speak out. I mean, I could do my show and I can rant and rave and talk about this every single week. And every other podcaster or YouTuber that you listen to or that you watch can also comment on it and rant about it. But you need to speak up. You need to make your voices heard. You need to tweet them. You need to email them. You need to post on their Facebook page. Don't hack into it like that one guy did on the 2K Facebook page. That was kind of funny. But you need to just speak up. Speak up. Let them know what you think. Make your voices heard. Maybe some people listening to this actually enjoy this right now. In that case, don't speak up. We need less of that. And we need more people speaking up against this shit because this just makes for horrible television. And it doesn't have to be that way. But you need to make your voices heard. It's not enough for me to come on here and say the things that I say. You need to go out there and make your voices heard. And things may not change. But they're sure as shit not going to change if nobody speaks up and says anything about it. Now, Survivor Series is coming up. We have the triple threat announced. United States Champion AJ Styles. Intercontinental Champion Shinsuke Nakamura. And the NXT North American champion, Roderick Strong, are going to have a triple threat match. Reportedly, the original plan was to have The Miz challenge The Fiend for the title at Survivor Series, which was to have kicked off with that Miz TV segment with Bray coming out of the Saudi Arabia show. Remember they announced Miz TV with Bray? So it looked like they were probably going to shoot the angle there to set the match up, but then everybody got stranded, and they were forced to improvise, and the segment never happened. Now, instead, we're getting Daniel Bryan challenging The Fiend for the championship, and that's a, and like I said, that's a fine match. I'm looking forward to it. But we also may have lost out on Daniel Bryan beating Shinsuke Nakamura ahead of the Survivor Series to win the Intercontinental Championship and getting Styles, Bryan, and Strong in a three-way, which would have been an incredible match. Which is not to say that AJ and Nakamura and Strong doesn't have the chance of being excellent as well. But AJ Styles, Daniel Bryan, and Roderick Strong, the old ROH crew, in a triple threat match at Survivor Series? That would have been off the charts. And now I am a sad panda. But that Universal title match is a definite upgrade now from what it would have been if it was Miz and The Fiend. Team Raw looks like this now. We've got Seth Rollins, Kevin Owens, Randy Orton, Ricochet, and Drew McIntyre against Team SmackDown, comprised of Roman Reigns, King Corbin, Braun Strowman, Chad Gable, and Mustafa Ali. It's almost like the old wildcard match at Survivor Series in 95. Gorilla Monsoon, he took heels and babyfaces, and he mixed them all up, and he put them against each other. So Team Raw, Team SmackDown, and whoever is on Team NXT... that'll be in a traditional Survivor Series elimination match. I'm not sure how this works, if it's tornado rules, three guys in at once, or if you do it the way that AEW did with their tag team title match at Full Gear with only two guys in the ring at once. They haven't exactly clarified the rules on how this this is going to work. Sin Cara requested his WWE release this week. This is becoming a trend now. Going on social media and announcing that you've asked for your release, and then looking stupid when you don't get it. Although in this case, he still might. I guess a decision has not yet been made on whether or not he will be granted his release. Thus far, the answer has been no. I hardly think that they would be worried about him going to an AEW. You know, the Sin Cara character is owned by WWE. It's been years since we've seen Hunico without the mask on. So if he leaves, I don't think that most people would even remember what he looks like, or they would even know that it was Sin Cara. Unless you're the hardest of hardcore fans. You know, but he chose a very odd time to post this long message requesting his release. He did so while overseas, in the middle of a European tour. I would have laughed if WWE immediately released him and then just left him there stranded and said, hey, get in, find your own way home. Like, they kick him off the bus. They, like, in the movies, they throw his bag off the bus. The bus speeds off. He's just left stranded in the middle of Milan or wherever the fuck they are this week. Or, I think they're in the UK somewhere. This is part of the statement that he posted, which it was translated from Spanish. I'm so grateful for the opportunity that WWE has given me. However, I realize that I am trapped in a place where I am not valued as an athlete or a talent. I have been loyal, respectful, a team player, and a supporter, and I have waited patiently for the opportunity to show the world what I can do. Unfortunately, after all of these years, that opportunity never arrived, and I feel like it will never arrive as long as I am here. The best years of my professional wrestling career are coming, and I believe that the best is yet to come. I am a healthy man, disciplined, respectful of my profession and its environment, of my colleagues, except Simon Gotch, who he threw a soda at that one time, but we'll put that on the side. And I think he actually gave Chris Jericho a black eye once. So we'll say he's respectful of most of his colleagues. And especially to my fans, who have never failed me. This is not the end. On the contrary, it is the beginning of the next chapter, and I am excited for everything the future holds. I want to thank WWE for this incredible chapter. He's right about one thing. That opportunity that he's looking for, it's never coming. He has been with this company now for almost a decade. Somewhere around 10 years, he has been in this company. 9 or 10 years. Most of that decade has been spent playing what is a dead character. It is a dead-end character on the fast track to nowhere. It's an easy paycheck for him. That's about all it is. He could re-sign for 5 years like some of these other people are doing. Lock him into a deal, make a little bit more money, and waste away what he feels are some of the best prime years of his career. If he has ambitions, though, of doing more, it's going to have to come outside of WWE and not under that mask. Now, he's said to have 3 years supposedly left on his deal, which makes sense because PW Insider had a report 2 years ago in October of 2017 that said he signed a new multi-year deal with WWE, but they never said for how many years. So let's assume it was a five-year deal. They love signing people to five-year deals. Let's say it was a five-year deal. He's now 2 years in. That would mean he's got 3 years left. The timing matches up. There was another report earlier this year that claimed that he signed the new deal, but he went on Twitter and he debunked it. He said it's just not true. If you remember, you know, Mystico, who was the hottest thing in Mexico for a while there, this is going back even more than a decade, Mystico came into WWE years ago, the original Mystico, or at least the one that got hot in the mid-2000s. He came in as the original Sin Cara. He was credited as being a Triple H signing. They had Triple H at the press conference. This was going to boost Triple H's, his pedigree, no pun intended, as an executive in the company. They credited him with the Awesome Kong signing as well as, what was the character that she played? Karma. Unfortunately, these two signings didn't work out very well for Triple H. He's redeemed himself with NXT in recent years. But these two signings ended up being a bust, and it wasn't even necessarily his fault. These were two talented people who were hot in the wrestling business at one time, and these were big pickups at the time for the company. They just didn't work out. Karma didn't last but all but a few months. I don't know that she ever had an official match outside of being in that one Royal Rumble. And Mystico was an epic fail. He was a colossal failure in WWE. But this was the guy that was going to be the second coming of Rey Mysterio. And his run was a colossal failure for a variety of different reasons. So to salvage the gimmick, they gave it to Hunico. Hunico was already under contract. They put Hunico under a mask. He also played the second Sin Cara Negro, right? Sin Cara Black, when the two of them were feuding for a time. We had the two Sin Caras that were feuding. And he's basically just been floating around ever since. And this was going back to like 2011. He has been floating. He's like a floating body, like a ghost. He's an apparition ever since. He's never gotten any kind of serious push. He is a warm body on the roster for this company. But this is becoming a pattern now. The money may be good. I doubt that any other company could offer the kind of money at this time, although that may be changing very soon. And you might even say with AEW, you know, they've got a billionaire backing them. If they wanted to match a big WWE offer, they could. But at the end of the day, at this moment, you're probably not going to be able to find more money anywhere but WWE. So the money may be good, but you reach a point where you just feel like you're wasting your best years away. And he obviously feels his best years are still ahead of him, which, you know, at 42 years old, he's 42. I question that. But he says he feels great, and hey, you know, age is but a number, I guess. I mean, look at Ricky Morton. He's out there doing Canadian destroyers and dives and tope suicidas at age 63. Age is but a number. Again, I look at not just Ricky Morton, I look at somebody like PCO. Look at PCO and Ring of Honor and what he's doing at 51, wrestling basically a full-time schedule. He may well win their world title next month at Final Battle. And so when you think of it in those terms, and you listen to what Sin Cara is saying here, his best years are ahead of him, hey, you never know. You never know. Now, per PWInsider.com, he was not the only person in WWE to request their release. Oney Lorcan has also asked for his release from WWE, although this apparently goes back about a month or so. We're only first hearing about this now. And it's not been confirmed by WWE or Lorcan himself, but he did change his name on all of his social media accounts back to his old ring name of Biff Busick. If you go on his Twitter, it says Biff Busick. You go on his Instagram, it says Biff Busick. He hasn't been seen on TV in about a month or so. He's been with the company for 4 years now. More recently, he was teamed up with Danny Burch in NXT. I always thought, you know, I always saw Oney Lorcan as sort of that veteran guy that Triple H would lean on, especially in NXT. Although he could have been that guy on the main roster as well. But that veteran guy, almost like a Bob Holly back in the day. Hard-nosed guy, tough as nails when he's in there with people. Oney is a very good wrestler. He's a great wrestler. But I always looked at him as that guy. Let's lean on him. Let's break this guy in. Let's see what this new kid's made of. We'll put him in there with Oney. Like, if he came along 20 years ago, he would have been that guy. He would have been a Steve Blackman or a Bob Holly type guy in WWE. And I always envision him eventually transitioning into a role as a coach for WWE, maybe at the Performance Center. He just seemed like that kind of guy who would be good in a role like that. And they've used him almost in a utility spot where you can plug him in on 205 Live. You can plug him in on NXT, wherever he's needed. And he can have good matches with almost anybody. Now, we don't know his reasons, but he's hardly the only one to ask for his release. And so we can speculate that his reasons are probably very similar to everyone else's and that he probably looks at this as a dead-end job and he wants to branch out and he wants to wrestle more and he wants to expand his horizons. And he maybe just felt that in WWE, he was spinning his wheels and wasn't really going anywhere. WWE, they've not yet granted his release. And again, if they do for him and not for everybody else, then how do they justify something like that? We see no value in you, so we'll let you go because we don't, you know, who cares if you go to AEW? What value do you have? But we're going to keep Mike Kanellis. We're not going to let him go. You know, Sin Cara, we're not going to let you go. We see more value in you than we do in Oney Lorcan. They need to be consistent, I think, with whatever their policy is. But they're racking up quite the body count of people who want out. It almost feels like a prison break. They're trying to escape Alcatraz. And then there's Jordan Miles, who is not even the angriest guy named Miles in the news this week. Miles Garrett made sure of that. He went on social media on a tirade a few weeks ago about WWE releasing that racist t-shirt for him, calling them a racist company. So he took this far beyond a single t-shirt. He called the entire company racist, from head to toe, from top to bottom. He posted a profanity-laced video this week, announcing that he has quit the company. As of today, I would like to officially announce that I quit fucking WWE. That makes it sound like they were having sex and he's done having sex with them now. I would like to officially announce that I quit fucking WWE. I am no longer employed. I refuse to work for racists. I fucking quit. Fuck them. I hate that fucking company and everything they fucking stand for. All they ever did was hold our fucking people back. I do this shit for the culture. I don't need anyone's fucking permission to do what I want to do. Screw Jordan Miles. Don't ever call me by that slave name. Call me ACH. And don't forget the super bitch. I quit. Fuck you. Tell us how you really feel. He later posted a second video that he has since deleted. Not only did he delete the video, he deleted his entire Twitter account. But now I see that it's back under a new handle. ACH is super. This is what he said. He goes, I want people to understand where I'm coming from with my anger. I am unhappy about the t-shirt that was made to show an image of me that was clearly disrespectful, not only to African Americans, but also to anybody who decided to purchase that t-shirt and show some kind of pride or appreciation for Jordan Miles. You have to understand that's how they view me. That is racism. That is wrong. That is not right. My first video was pure emotion, and there was a lot of rage behind it because I was clearly upset. Now that I've had time to think about this and I've had time to gather my thoughts, I want everybody to know that I will no longer be employed by WWE because I refuse to approach people that have offended me. My entire career has been me approaching people that have disrespected me and have shown me absolutely no love or the same respect that I have shown them. I am tired of the way that this wrestling culture is today. They don't treat the younger guys with respect. All the old guard walking around here thinking that we owe them something because they've taken a couple of more bumps than us, that's bullshit. I'm tired of it. This is for the culture, not just for African Americans, but for everybody that has ever felt like they could not do anything in their life. This is much bigger than pro wrestling. This is way much bigger than WWE or the McMahons. This is bigger than life. This is a stand, and me and the people will take it to the world, and we will take it to their throats first. He also took a page from Cody Rhodes and tweeted a photo of a wish list with five names written on it. At least I hope that's a wish list. Naming Jonathan Gresham, Darius Lockhart, AJ Gray, Myron Reed, and Desmond Xavier. I just saw Desmond last night, actually. He was in that suicidal six-way at the HOG show. Very impressive. So, Jordan Miles, from winning the breakout tournament in August to this, from breakout to breakdown, that sums up this Jordan Miles story in a nutshell. And he may have his reasons for breaking down publicly. We don't yet have all the details. We know about the t-shirt stuff. You heard his statement there. He mentions the t-shirt. He mentions the t-shirt again. And he claims it's all about the t-shirt. Given the level of anger here, I don't buy that it's just the t-shirt. I think the t-shirt was the tipping point for him. But I don't believe that the t-shirt is the root cause of what's going on here. There may have been something else that happened at the Performance Center. Maybe there was something that was said to him that he found deeply offensive. Because, again, he's talking about the company as a whole, not just the t-shirt. So this goes far deeper than any one single t-shirt. You know, the Observer had a report that said that he's been missing from the PC, and he's been out since late September on some kind of medical leave, but that it's not injury-related. There's something else going on here. I still think him insulting Jay Lethal the way that he did and then refusing to apologize for it is bullshit. Lethal did not deserve that. Even if he has some kind of legitimate gripe or beef, if Jay Lethal played politics with him in Ring of Honor, if he feels in his mind that he's got some excuse to hold this anger and this resentment of Jay Lethal, to go out in this public tirade and use the language that he used and say the things that he said and drag Jay Lethal into it, who had absolutely nothing to do with any of this, is bullshit. I don't care what his explanation is. It's bullshit. Nor has anybody forgotten about that, nor should anybody forget about that. I have no issue with him calling WWE out on all the other stuff if that's how he feels, or if he can prove and back up that someone said something to him, if something horrendous happened, by all means, go ahead and call them out. And if he's that unhappy, then he should be able to leave and go somewhere else. But here's the problem, and this piggybacks off what I just got done talking about with Oney Lorcan and Sin Cara. Here is the problem from the WWE point of view. They have now set a precedent by not letting guys go when they want out of their contracts early. They let Dustin Rhodes go, because he played it close to the vest. I think he played dumb. He didn't tell them that he was going to go to AEW. They let him go. They let Sean Spears go. Also, probably didn't think he was going to go to AEW. Both guys leave. Where do they end up? They go to AEW. And so ever since, they have not let anybody out of their contract who has requested a release. And I don't really see that changing anytime soon either. It might. If they see someone is of no value to them, maybe they'll just say, fuck it, we'll let the guy go. But they have not let anybody go since those two guys earlier this year. Sean Spears was the last one. He was the last one to escape. Okay? It's like jury duty. But because again, the problem that they have now is they've set this precedent. And so it's like jury duty. For years, if you didn't want to get picked for a jury, people would say, just go say something incredibly racist. Go say something incredibly offensive to an entire group of people when they interview you. Tell the court that you can't be impartial because you hate this person, you hate that person. I could never bring myself to do that. But guess what? It doesn't work anyway. Not anymore. When I got picked to be on that grand jury a couple of years back, I can't tell you how many people pitched all kinds of excuses to the judge about why they couldn't be picked. They brought us all into this giant courtroom like you would see on Law and Order. And we're all sitting in the jury, in the witness box. And there's the judge, and there's the attorney, and they have a microphone they put in your hand as they go down the line and they interview each of you. And I cannot tell you how many people pitched all kinds of excuses about why they couldn't be picked. They've got a sick parent at home they have to take care of. Which I fit into that category back then, although I didn't use that as an excuse. But they've got a sick parent at home, or they're a single parent working two jobs with three kids. They've gotten hip to all of these excuses. So the judge would tell them, okay, I'll let you leave. You want to leave here, I'll let you leave. But you're going right back downstairs to the jury pool. You're going to be sitting around all day waiting to be called. And if you get picked for a regular jury, it could be a lot worse, because then you'd have to report every day until the trial is over. At least with a grand jury, like in my case, I only had to go once a week, every Friday. Now, that turned out to be for an entire year. I was a designated juror for 12 months, although towards the end I wasn't going every week. I was on call in case they needed us. So I didn't expect it to go that. They liked us so much because they have the right. They can keep you up to 18 months. And I guess we did such a good job, they said, you know what, we're going to re-enlist you for another 6 months above and beyond the first 6 months. That was quite the ordeal. But aside from that, it really wasn't so bad. I was fucked from the start. Young, single guy with no kids, I never stood a chance. There was no way I wasn't going to get picked. The point is, why am I telling this story? If they release him, if they let him go, what is to stop Luke Harper or Sin Cara or Oney Lorcan from posting a cuss-filled rant on social media accusing WWE of being racist, accusing WWE of being sexist, accusing WWE of some kind of discriminatory behavior, you know, discriminating against men with beards? They see Jordan Miles get his release. Well, then why not go scorched earth like he did? Just to get out of their contract. Now, maybe they will let Miles go. Maybe they don't want the publicity and they'll come to some kind of a mutual understanding and say, look, this guy's a giant headache. We don't want to have anything to do with him anymore. The bridge has been burned. Let's just part ways. Maybe they'll just cut their losses. As of this recording, he has not been granted his release. He said as much in a Q&A that he did on Twitter yesterday. I am unemployed as of today. No, you're not. No, you're not. He can say whatever he wants to about I quit, I'm unemployed, I'm no longer employed by WWE. In your mind, it's a fantasy land he lives in. He is still under contract to WWE. Does not mean he is free and clear to go wherever he wants. And I got news for you. No company is going to touch this guy if they think that they might get sued by WWE for tampering with somebody who is still under contract. He just signed his contract this year, I think back in February. So he could have a substantial amount of time left, which could make for a very messy divorce. After closing the ratings gap to just 9,000 viewers between the two shows the week before, AEW again pulled away to notch its seventh straight ratings win this past week over NXT. AEW Dynamite did 957,000 overnight viewers, so creeping back up closer to a million. That's up from the 822,000 they did the week before. This was the post-Full Gear edition, so there may have been a post-pay-per-view bounce. I guess we'll find out if they drop back down this week, if that's the case. But that was the best rating in over a month for the show. With NXT on USA, they brought in 750,000 overnight viewers, down from 822,000 the week before. That was the lowest NXT on USA overnight audience to date. Dynamite had, I thought, the segment of the week, the awesome Chris Jericho MJF promo battle in the ring before they embraced, of course, and then Cody came out. And we had also the debut in that same segment of Wardlow. So everyone was going nuts in the chat during the live stream for Wardlow on Wednesday. And anyway, I enjoyed that segment. I thought it was great. It is kind of scary to think how good at age 23 MJF is as far as having that character just nailed down to a T. He doesn't crack. He's so easy to hate. He'll end up turning himself into a babyface, but there's still time for that to happen. He got genuine heel heat, though, when he turned on Cody at Full Gear. It wasn't the kind of, like, cool heat. People hated his guts. He got splashed with beer. I mean, you know, you want that kind of visceral reaction when you're a heel. And so whatever he's doing, he just has to keep doing it. And I said in my Dynamite review, now the question is, if he's aligned with Wardlow, who came out to help him beat up Cody, is it going to be a case where MJF is not doing as much wrestling, but he's sort of managing Wardlow as this monster? Or is Wardlow going to be the diesel to MJF's Shawn Michaels, where we're going to start finally seeing MJF in the ring more, and Wardlow isn't going to be doing too much wrestling, but for starters here, he'll be in MJF's corner as his bodyguard or his insurance policy. We don't know. And I've never seen a Wardlow match. I know very little about this guy. I've never seen him work before. I have no idea what he's capable of. I don't know if he's got two left feet. I don't know if he's very impressive for a big guy like that. So when I see my first Wardlow match, I'll probably be seeing my first Wardlow match along with many of you. MJF, we have seen very little of him in the ring in AEW. We did in those early months when they had Fight for the Fallen or Fighter Fest or some of those shows. We have yet to see him do much of anything, though, in the ring on Dynamite. He wrestles in MLW. I haven't seen all of his work there. But I'm also curious to see what kind of in-ring performer he turns out to be. You know, is he a very basic performer, punches and kicks and some basic heel moves? Does he do anything impressive? See, I don't think a guy like MJF needs to go in there and dive. He doesn't have to do all that stuff, I don't think. He can really rely on his character and just doing whatever he has to do to get people to absolutely hate his stinking guts. You can leave the dives for everybody else, the Joey Janelas and the Darby Allins and the Lucha Bros and the Young Bucks. Not everybody has to dive and do wacky, crazy moves off the top rope. I don't get the sense that's what MJF does. So I'm curious, who gets featured more here? Is it more a case of MJF managing Wardlow, or is it the other way around? Anyway, join me every Wednesday. I'm live on YouTube at 10 p.m. for the Dynamite stream. We have a good time. And you can check out the archived version of the most recent review. I went into more detail about other aspects of the show. It's all in the archives. If 10 p.m. is past your bedtime, you can always check it out there. I talked about that segment. I talked about the knife-wielding Awesome Kong and Scorpio Sky getting a shock pin over Chris Jericho at the end of the show, handing Jericho his very first defeat in AEW and where I think all of this is going. This Wednesday's lineup is pretty loaded. The show they've already announced for Wednesday is a pretty big lineup. They've got Santana and Ortiz taking on Private Party. This is a match that is dedicated to the memory of the late Matt Travis. There were members of both teams who were at the HOG show last night. They weren't on the show, but they were there. You know, I saw Santana was there, Ortiz was there. I think Isaiah Cassidy, I didn't see Mark Quinn, but they were all there last night to be part of the show. It's going to be a very emotional night for them, and this is a big match for these two teams. And we already know what these two teams, especially Private Party, are capable of in the ring. So I expect this, if they give them some time, this could just steal the show. So that's a big match. Matt Jackson is kayfabe injured after the attack by Santana and Ortiz, and so Nick Jackson is going to have his first singles match on Dynamite, one-on-one against Rey Fénix. That's going to be a very interesting match. I'm looking forward to that. Darby Allin, he answered the challenge, the gauntlet thrown down by Jon Moxley. So we've got Darby Allin against Jon Moxley. And we have what they're calling the Dynamite Dozen Battle Royal, with the final two men standing facing off the following week on Dynamite in a singles match, with the winner winning a fancy diamond ring. I'm not sold on this concept yet. I haven't seen what the ring looks like. They haven't explained what it means. Is it like a title? Are you going to be able to defend it? You know, does it earn you a championship match? We don't know. But that's a pretty loaded lineup coming up on Wednesday. NXT this past week was another excellent show. Not to take anything away from NXT. They've been on a roll of late. A string of excellent shows. See? Competition. Lights a fire under everyone's ass. Which is, I'm not saying NXT was slacking before, but there's a definite energy on the show now that was not there before. And a lot of big matches that I don't think you would ordinarily have seen on the weekly television show. Now they're on USA. Now they're running opposite another wrestling company. So they're amping things up. They're giving us big matches. They're doing this main roster invasion heading into Survivor Series. My favorite thing on the show on Wednesday was the opener. Leo Rush defending his Cruiserweight title against Angel Garza. What a frickin' match this was, and what a difference it makes having these big Cruiserweight matches at Full Sail. You know, I know I wasn't watching 205 Live every single week, but you would hear me on this podcast from time to time if I heard, oh man, you gotta watch this big championship match, it was awesome. I'd go back and I would watch it, and I would review some of them here on the show. And a lot of those matches involved Mustafa Ali and Buddy Murphy. So I would occasionally watch these big championship matches on 205 Live. But I saw enough of them in front of mostly dead or indifferent crowds where ultimately in the end they would win the crowd over, which is a testament, I think, to the performers. But I thought, you know, had those matches taken place here, you take those matches and you put them in front of this crowd, at Full Sail inside that NXT arena, they would be remembered for years to come in WWE as classic matches. And a lot of those matches won't be remembered at all. It's almost like they never even happened because the audience was so small. And so it's a shame, really. But I think this really showed the power of having these matches in this kind of setting. This is where it should be on a regular basis. You know, because it's almost like the old if a tree falls in the woods analogy. So I think making the Cruiserweight title an NXT property was absolutely the right move to make. Leo Rush had his wife and kids in the front row watching. Early in the match, I love this spot. Angel Garza runs over to them. He hops the barricade. He goes into the crowd. He's right next to Leo's wife and his kids. And he tears his pants off, because that's his gimmick. He has the tearaway pants. So he doesn't do it in the ring. He goes in front of the man's wife. And he rips his pants off, right in front of her. And Leo Rush comes soaring like a missile, flying through the ropes like a torpedo. He tried to kill this guy. At least he went after the guy. He didn't just stand there in the ring making mean faces like they do on Monday nights. Garza hit a fallaway moonsault slam off the top rope, which looked as dangerous as it sounds. Thankfully, Leo Rush is all of 170 pounds probably, so he was able to get him over. Rush hit the final hour frog splash, only got a two count. He hit it a second time. But Garza was so close to the ropes, his foot caught the bottom rope when Leo went to hook the leg, which should have been a rope break, but the referee didn't see it, and so he counted the three, and it affected the crowd reaction. It affected my reaction, too, to the end of the match. Didn't ruin the match, but it struck me as a botch. Maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was planned that way, but it did not strike me as something that was planned. If they bring it up again on TV this week and it leads to a rematch, they can make an angle out of it, even if it was a botch. But it kind of mucked up the finish to what was otherwise, I thought, a fantastic Cruiserweight match. That's the kind of Cruiserweight match that would have not only fit in on Nitro 20 years ago, it would have been better than most of the Cruiserweight matches we got on Nitro. Xia Li and Aaliyah barely got going before Xia Li delivered a roundhouse kick to the face and broke Aaliyah's nose. That must have been one hell of a kick, because Aaliyah had her hands up, it looked like, and somehow she still got her face smashed in. I've watched this about 10 times now. I still can't understand how she broke her face up like that. Xia pinned her, Dr. rushed in, she was spitting up blood into a towel. She would not be the only woman left bloody on this show. Aaliyah later tweeted a photo of her bloody face, put it on her Twitter page. She was in tears. She's like Bizarro Becky Lynch. Is Becky the only one who actually knows how to use social media in this company? We know her fiancé doesn't. But I mean, the women. Is she the only one? You know, Vanessa Bourne, who is in Aaliyah's corner, she also tweeted. She says, "Wow, let's give it up for the sloppiest person in the locker room, Xia Li. Bravo, you've outdone yourself." This is stupid. She's either throwing Xia Li under the bus for real, or it's all an angle based on the premise of this is all fake and you're not really supposed to be hurting us. Here's a lesson to aspiring wrestlers from yours truly, and I say this just as a humble fan. Don't do that. This is stupid. We had a Finn Balor promo. He called NXT a joke. What happened to this place? Johnny Gargano, he's the heart and soul of NXT, and yet he's still out. He's still out from, you know, something that happened 3 weeks ago. That's my Finn Balor impression. Johnny Gargano, he's out. He's still out. Something that happened 3 weeks ago. Anyway, Matt Riddle, guys, a terrible impersonation. Matt Riddle comes out. He goes after Finn Balor. With Johnny Gargano now off the TakeOver show. He's got a neck injury. They have moved Matt Riddle out of the War Games match and into a singles match with Finn Balor, which is A-OK with me. Keith Lee beat Roderick Strong with his Ground Zero finish to build up the War Games match a little bit more. Hopefully also earns him a North American title match at some point, because he beat the champion here. If you beat the champion, you either become the champion or you get a title shot. Otherwise, this was dumb. If you're going to do that, you got to do it the right way. Again, at least get a title match out of it. Undisputed Era, they attacked Lee and Tommaso Ciampa when the match was over, until Dominik Dijakovic, he came out to make the save, and he told Ciampa, I want to be on your team, I want to be part of War Games. Then he shook hands with Keith Lee. So Dijakovic takes Matt Riddle's place with one spot still left open. And the name that would make the most sense to fill that spot is an obvious one. Since Undisputed Era took him out, it would be Velveteen Dream. But that depends entirely on whether or not he's even cleared to come back. I mean, if you know they had this spot originally for Matt Riddle, then obviously there were no plans for Velveteen Dream to even be in this match. So unless he makes a sudden miraculous recovery, my guess is it won't be him, but he would be the name that makes the most sense. Now, if he can't make it, you know, they have been pushing Isaiah Swerve Scott on TV of late. He's been getting a bit of a push. They could always slot him in there. I don't like that, though, because he's got no beef with the Undisputed Era. He's got no issue with them. So he would just feel shoehorned in there. I guess anybody would, I guess, other than Velveteen Dream, but I guess they may have no choice. Pete Dunne, Damian Priest, and Killian Dane, they're all occupied with one another. They were mixing it up here on this show. I did enjoy the diesel trim on Damian Priest's tights, or trunks, tights, right? I always get the two confused. He got, go back and watch him here, and then compare him to Diesel from 94 or 95, the gear that Diesel was wearing. He was wearing the diesel trim. These were the diesel tights that he had on. You know, hopefully his matches will be a little more exciting than some of those diesel matches in 95 with guys like Sid and Mabel. I can't even put that all on Diesel. Diesel had some good matches with Bret Hart and Shawn Michaels and some other people, but my God, fucking King Mabel. SummerSlam 95, or actually one of the most horrendous matches of 1995, which was kind of surprising given that the Bulldog was involved and the Bulldog was generally a good wrestler. But there was a pay-per-view In Your House match in, I think, Winnipeg in October of 95 with Bret Hart on commentary. And it was Diesel against the British Bulldog. It was one of the worst matches I've ever seen. So bad that when that pay-per-view was over, Vince McMahon allegedly threw down his headset in disgust and marched off. Even he knew that it was a stinker. So yeah, Diesel had some good matches, but he had some real clunkers in 95 as well. Anyway, Damian Priest is very talented. He does dives, right? Everybody does dives. He does dives. But no, he's a good wrestler, so I'm looking forward to seeing. I assume it's going to be a triple-threaded takeover that hasn't been made official yet. Throughout the show, women were being laid out left and right, outside the building. First, it was Rhea Ripley and Tegan Knox. Then it was Marina Shafir, Jessamyn Duke, and Candice LeRae. Scarlett Bordeaux made her NXT debut. She was kneeling down next to Candice to check on her as Triple H came over to find out what the hell's going on. And to ask Scarlett when the hell her boyfriend's Impact deal is up so he can come make some real money and become a big star. You couldn't hear that part, but I have impeccable hearing. He whispered it under his breath. So with all of this havoc going on, we got a segment in the back where Dakota Kai made mention of all the attacks. She goes up to Mia Yim. Boy, you know, all these women are being attacked. I just want you to know I've got your back tonight if anything goes down. And I just thought, this is very suspicious. She's being way too nice. That led to the ladder match between Mia Yim and Io Shirai to determine which team gets the advantage in the women's War Games match. They had a briefcase hanging from the ceiling. Instead of a Money in the Bank contract inside, they stuffed it with an old Jordan Miles t-shirt since they don't know what to do with them now. Kind of like the way I felt about Britt Baker's matches in AEW up until her most recent one, I have not really been impressed with the matches that I have seen Mia Yim having in NXT since she came over. This was, I thought, a breakout performance for her. This was the best match of her entire NXT run. She hasn't had that many of them. This was the best match, maybe of her life. I can't say for sure. I didn't see all of her matches in Impact. But this turned out to be a hell of a match. And Mia became the second female casualty of the night in the ring, not counting all the ladies, of course, who were left for dead outside the building. Io springboarded into a missile dropkick. She kicked the ladder back into Mia's face. This looked absolutely just brutal as all hell. She kicked that shit right into her face. And Mia's face down on the mat. You can see blood is leaking from her face. It looked like the bridge of her nose was broken or injured. Eventually, then the match came to a halt, as is the case now with all these matches when somebody starts bleeding. I mean, look, far be it for me to say don't take their safety with any kind of priority. Safety is the most important thing. But this is the biggest difference between addressing these injuries the way they address them now as opposed to how they would have addressed them years ago. The one drawback is it just grinds the match to a screeching halt and you lose out on a lot of that drama when they, oh, we have to wipe the blood away. You don't think that most of these wrestlers would, if they had the choice, would love to just shove the guy away and say, leave me alone, let the blood flow, let the blood pour. It's a great visual. Because it is. And that's kind of lost now, you know, in a lot of these matches because they do take these things more seriously. And again, I'm not saying that's a bad thing, but you definitely lose some of the momentum and some of the drama, you know. And I think for the injuries that aren't as serious, leave it alone. You know, if the performer says they're okay and you check them out and it's not some kind of catastrophic injury, then just leave it and let it become part of the match and you can address it when the match is over. But the match came to a screeching halt. And eventually they let her continue. I guess it turned out to not be as serious, although they did say later on that it was a fractured nasal fracture, so I guess technically she did break her nose. Dakota Kai came down to the ring to check on Mia. Both of them were taken out by an Io Shirai moonsault on the floor. Dakota stopped Io from climbing the ladder, gave her the sit-out powerbomb, rolled Mia back inside. The whole time I'm watching this, I'm thinking, when's she going to turn? When's she going to turn? It never happened. All of a sudden, out came the NXT UK Women's Champion, Kaylee Ray. She laid out Dakota Kai. She pushes the ladder over with Mia Yim on it, and Mia takes this gigantic bump out over the top rope and through a ladder bridge on the outside. These are the wooden ladders that they gimmick up, that they paint. You could tell because it just broke in half. You see all the wood chips. But even still, that was a terrifying bump to take. And I wouldn't doubt if she hurt her. They claim that she hurt her ribs. She may have broken her ribs. I feel like that may be a kayfabe injury. But if you told me it was a real injury, I wouldn't be surprised. She came crashing down through this ladder. And that allowed Io Shirai to pull down the briefcase and get the win. So the heels get the advantage in the War Games match, as it should be. We'll see if they do the same thing this Wednesday. It's going to be Adam Cole and Dijakovic in a ladder match of their own for the man advantage at War Games. But it looks like Kaylee Ray is going to be the fourth member of Team Shayna Baszler. That has not been official yet, I don't think. Shayna came out on stage to applaud in approval when Bayley sneak attacked her from behind, then ran off with Bianca Belair in hot pursuit. I don't know if Bayley was wearing heels or what, but she was running slow enough that Bianca had to comically slow herself down so as not to catch up with her. They want you to think that it was Kaylee Ray. I think they want you to think that it was her behind those attacks throughout the night, but I mean, if you think about it, it really wouldn't make much sense, right? Because if she's with Shayna, and Shayna comes out and she's clapping and she's very impressed by Kaylee Ray, why would she take out Shayna's friends? Whoever took out all the women also took out Jessamyn Duke and Marina Shafir. So that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. You know who would make sense? Dakota Kai. Not only does she have beef with Shayna and her friends, if she's jealous that Mia effectively took her spot in the War Games match, then she might want to take out Rhea Ripley and Tegan Nox and Candice LeRae as well. But then on SmackDown, she was out there teaming with them. So I have no idea if that's the direction they're going in with this. I kind of like the fact that they're keeping us thinking. It just Dakota still seems like the right person, though, to have done all of that. But I guess, you know, would Dakota Kai be able to lay all these people out by herself? It would seem that she would need some help. After the show was over, people in the building filmed Mia Yim walking to the back. Her boyfriend, Keith Lee, walked out on stage to show her some love. And then he delivered the pounce and knocked her clear off the stage. No, I'm kidding. They kissed and they walked to the back. I said before she was diagnosed with a nasal fracture, which is a fancy name for a broken nose. She's already been cleared, though. 2 nights later, there she was on SmackDown. So I guess she'll be good to go for War Games. And just some top-line thoughts here real quick on NWA Power Episode 6, the highlights. Trevor Murdoch, he's still fighting for an NWA contract. He picked up a win over Caleb Conley, so his story continues. Aaron Stevens, coming off his loss to Ricky Starks, he quit. He pulled the Jordan Miles. And he said that he's going back to Hollywood, never to return. Hint, hint. He's not going back to Hollywood. He will return. Thunder Rosa and Marty Bell teamed up to beat Crystal Rose and Brooklyn Creed. Anyone named Brooklyn is okay with me. Until she lost. She embarrassed the entire borough of Brooklyn, and now she's dead to me. James Storm, he's not happy about losing his national title the week before to Colt Cabana. He says he was robbed. Even though, if you go back and watch the end of that show from the week before, Cabana, he gave Colt a thumbs up as he left the ring, so he couldn't have been that upset with him. But he's got bigger fish to fry, he says. He's going to be gunning for Nick Aldis in the World's Heavyweight title. Meanwhile, Colt Cabana comes out to talk to Dave Marquez. He says he'll fight anyone. He should go find where Aleister Black's room is and knock on his door. Aleister Black is waiting for a fight. Fight me. He can go fight him for the national title. This brings out Ricky Starks, who says, and I quote, "Crocodile leather is his pleasure, and that he's sold on gold." He rhymes every week. It's very talented, is this Ricky Starks. After weeks of hype, the question mark made his debut. He beat Dan Parker with a karate strike, a little bit of karate. He looked an awful lot like Josephus to me under that mask, but I don't know who it was. Maybe it was that Orange Cassidy guy. Maybe it's me. Maybe it's me, and I'm just stringing all of you along. Why not? Apparently, I look like every other white guy who ever walked the face of the earth. I've been told I look like no less than 5 different people. I was told I looked like Daniel Bryan all those years ago. Then I looked like Jack Swagger. Then at WrestleMania in Miami, when we interviewed Kofi Kingston, he told me I looked like John Laurinaitis, which offended me. I laughed when he lost his title to Brock Lesnar. That's what you get, Kofi Kingston. Then everybody says I look like this Orange Cassidy guy. Now the other day on Twitter, someone says that I look like this Spanish soccer player, Iker Muniain. Is that his name? Iker Muniain? However the hell you pronounce it. If any of these people ever commit a felony and the cops ask for a sketch of the suspect, I'm fucked. Eli Drake, he wants to take the world's title from Nick Aldis and says that he can make Camille squeal. We got a taped message from Billy Corgan thanking the fans for their support. Their December tapings are now sold out and they have something big planned, but you got to sign up for the NWA email list. That way you'll be the first to know what it is when they are ready to make this announcement. Maybe he saved 15% on his car insurance by switching to Geico. And the Wild Cards retain their NWA tag team titles over Homicide and Eddie Kingston, which would seem to put those two in the rearview mirror as far as the tag title picture is concerned. Nick Aldis was sitting ringside as an observer for this match. When it was over, Camille walked out. And Aldis stops her, and the two of them were kind of going at it. They have a little bit of a confrontation. James Storm walks out. Ken Anderson walks out. Now there's a giant, you know, just back and forth. Not a brawl, but they're all arguing back and forth. The Wild Cards come over. The Dawsons walk out. Colt Cabana comes out. Eli Drake comes out. It's like a promo battle royal. And the entire time, they're playing Into the Fire by Dokken in the background. So we don't hear any noise coming from the arena, from the studio, rather. We just hear the song playing, and then eventually the credits roll. And we still have not heard Camille speak. Or squeal. I guess there's time for that to happen. Now, this is a pretty neat story. I did want to cover this because I did get... I got a whole bunch of messages from people, but I already had this on my list to talk about anyway. This is a pretty neat story. I guess these two guys, Ant and Deck, are popular TV personalities from across the pond in the UK. They're TV presenters and hosts. Anthony McPartlin and Declan Donnelly. Those are their full names. I had never heard of them before this. But I guess they've also been on Britain's Got Talent, which would explain why I've never heard of them, because why the hell would I watch that? I don't like America's Got Talent. I don't think America has talent, but that's beside the point. They've been best friends since they were 13 years old. Well, they filmed a documentary that just aired on ITV. It took them 3 years to make this thing called Ant and Dex DNA Journey. And spoiler alert, the big reveal at the end is that they're actually related. They trace their bloodlines all the way back to the skeleton of a Viking. The Viking Raider Warrior experience through their father's bloodlines. They think the Viking died somewhere around the year 790 AD. Ric Flair was only taking his first steps that year. So the payoff to this entire documentary is that they find out they're distant cousins, okay? Who gives a shit? Why am I bringing this up? Along the path of their DNA journey, they come to find out about another person that they are related to, or Declan is anyway. He got a DNA hit on his father's side. A four times great-grandfather, six generations ago, that he shares this DNA hit with Dixie Carter. Yes, that Dixie Carter, not designing women Dixie Carter. TNA Impact, Dixie Carter. I share a birthday with Dixie. This guy shares a great-grandfather with Dixie. So on the show, they arrange for a meeting in Ireland. And Dixie shows up to meet the both of them, and they're showing footage of her taking that big powerbomb bump off the top rope, the Bubba Bomb, through a table on impact by Bubba Ray. And they ask, or Bully Ray, I guess. And they ask her about it, and she says that she broke her back for real on that bump, which is true. I mean, she wasn't in traction or anything like that, but she broke two small bones in her back on that bump, legit. And these guys kept talking about her like, she's a wrestler. Oh my God, you're related to a wrestler. Like, I think they actually thought that she wrestled and then later on became an executive or something later in life. Like in the annals of women's wrestling history, I don't recall Dixie Carter's name alongside names like Moolah and Mae Young and Mildred Burke, but maybe I need to brush up on my history. So Dixie said that she took the Ancestry DNA test and found that her DNA is 37% Irish. So she has Irish roots on both sides of her family for that number to be that high. She said that her father, Bob Carter, Panda Energy Bob, was adopted when he was 3 years old, and her adopted grandparents couldn't have children. So every year around Christmas time, there was an orphanage, and they would take some kids in, and then I guess they would be adopted by somebody else. That's the basic gist of the story. But Ant and Deck were most interested in the fact that her family's energy company did $5 billion in revenue over the last few years. Or at least that's what Dixie claims. But it's an energy company, so I don't doubt for a second that they made billions of dollars. But imagine finding out that you're related to a billionaire family. You are related to a billionaire. From TNA Impact to DNA Impact. I never thought I would see the day that I would be hoping for Dixie Carter to make her WWE debut. I was thinking about her recently. When I was thinking about EC3. And I never thought I would be sitting here thinking, man, you know, Dixie Carter should make her debut in WWE because it may be the only thing to save EC3's career at this point would be to bring her in, you know, play off their history. I know that means they would have to play off an Impact storyline, which they probably are loath to want to do. Although they let him keep the EC3 name. They never bothered explaining on TV what EC3 even stands for. In all the years he's been there, it's just EC3. Three meaningless letters and numbers, it just means nothing in WWE. But if wanted to, there's nothing stopping them from acknowledging the fact that he is related to this woman and explaining who she is. And I don't know how they would even explain that. They're not going to mention Impact by name. Point is, I actually think bringing in Dixie Carter is the only thing that will save EC3's career. He's basically a lost cause, and MJF is now a better version of EC3 in AEW, I know that. But Dixie coming in to rescue her nephew's career could be entertaining, I think, with the right story. No RSPW Rewind this week. I'm taking a break this week because I just ran out of time. I had so many different things going on in the HOG show. And then I looked at the lineup for this week's show, and I said, this is a long freaking show. I said, you know what, let's give it a break for 1 week. Absence makes the heart grow fonder. I got a good one for you next week. So RSPW Rewind will resume next week. I will take a couple of mailbag questions and then we'll wrap up here. You can always email me, thesolomonster at gmail.com. Please include your name and where you are from when you write in. Mosin from Mississauga. The elephant in the room will really be addressed by the fans. I don't know where Raw is tomorrow, but I'm pretty sure fans will be chanting for CM Punk, making it a relevant chant after so long. I feel the fans' pressure will only intensify the process. This is in reference to Punk returning to the ring. And we will see him in the ring, even sooner than later because of it. You mentioned on the Sound Off Extra that you did, there is no current dream match for CM Punk. I really think that even at this stage of their careers, Punk and Triple H is a dream match. I think that program would be absolutely great TV. What do you think? I agree. I think it would be great TV. I don't look at it as a dream match. I mean, by the definition of what I think a dream match is, I guess in your case, you would think it's a dream match. I look at a dream match as a match, not just a match that you like or you love and you can't wait to see it, but it's a match that you never thought would be possible for whatever reason. You just never thought it would happen. And then one day, all of a sudden, it becomes possible. So by that definition, I guess for you, it would be a dream match. I think people throw that word around way too much. That's not a dream match to me. But I do agree that the weekly television, if they let these guys go out there, and look, when they feuded all those years ago, some of the promos were very compelling and they were drawing off real feelings. If they let them go out there and do that again and play off Punk leaving the company and all the anger and all the angst and everything, I think it could make for some very fun, compelling television segments and promos. I don't have a great feeling about the match itself, and it's not a match that I'm clamoring to see. But I could see where some people would be. But I don't think there is such a thing at this point that really exists. When I look up and down the roster of dream matches for CM Punk, I don't doubt that he could go in there and have some really good matches with some of the people on that roster. Am I sitting here clamoring and daydreaming about a CM Punk match against somebody specific? No. Years ago, it would have been Austin. But again, that ship, not only did it not sail, it never left the dock. I said this the other night. There was never any chance, looking back on it, of that match happening, because Austin was never coming back. He was stringing everybody along. He was never coming back. And now, forget about it. He's older. He's definitely not coming back if he hasn't come back after all these years. So I don't see a dream match in the pipeline for CM Punk. But I do think it can make for some very compelling TV. So I'm kind of torn. I wouldn't say that I'm completely against it. But I also would not call it a dream match. For me, it's not a dream match. And Alex in St. Paul, Minnesota. I read a source that talked about an incident in 1994 after a house show in Anaheim, California. Apparently, this woman was hanging out with the wrestlers the night before. And the morning after, she was in a hallway with police officers, and the hallway was covered in blood and her hair was partially shaved. Jimmy Del Rey of the Heavenly Bodies and Tatanka were accused of the incident, but Tatanka was not involved in any of it. Do you have more to this story? Yes. Kevin Nash actually calls this the Helter Skelter incident. I think I've binged most of his shoot interviews that I've seen online over the years. Look, say what you want to about Kevin Nash, and not every story he tells is to be believed, and it's from his perspective. He's a great storyteller, though. I have to say, I really enjoy the Kevin Nash shoot interviews whenever they pop up. He does the best ones. I especially enjoy the ravioli one, where he's sitting at a table in a restaurant somewhere with the interviewer, just staring at him, eating a plate of ravioli throughout the interview. That was fun. But in one of his kayfabe commentary shoots, Kevin Nash insists that Tatanka had nothing to do with what happened, and he thinks it was Jimmy Del Rey who did it. Now, he doesn't have any proof of this, but he says he thinks it was Jimmy Del Rey. Gigolo Jimmy Del Rey. I don't know if the accusation is that he roofied her, or, you know, Nash used the term H-bomb, that she was H-bombed, meaning Halcyon. The story goes there was an incident in a hotel after a house show in Anaheim in 94. There were rumors that this woman was a groupie or a ring rat, whatever phrase you want to use, who hung around the wrestlers. And it wasn't until later in 1995 that she came forward about this alleged incident. And when she did, she named Tatanka and Del Rey as the men who attacked her. I think she claimed that they abused her and shaved her head on one side. Nash claimed the woman was having drinks with him and The Undertaker the night before, I guess at the hotel bar. The goth girl, that's what he called her, the goth girl. She was hanging out with Nash and The Undertaker. Maybe Austin can ask Undertaker about this during his Stone Cold podcast in a couple of weeks. But the next morning, you know, Nash is getting ready to leave. He goes out in the hallway and he sees the walls of the hallway are smeared with blood. And he sees the woman with the cops and she's crying. And, you know, again, half of her head is shaved. And he said Tatanka was with Del Rey, but that there's no way he could have done anything. He says he didn't do anything wrong. I'm not sure what evidence of this. I'm not sure how he can be so sure unless he was there himself. But he said, wrongfully accused. So the following year, right? So again, fast forward to 95, almost a year after this allegedly happened. And WWE gets word of this pending lawsuit that this woman is getting ready to file. And they suspend Tatanka. And he disappeared off television for a few months before they brought him back at the beginning of 96. I'm pretty sure Del Rey was already gone from the company by this point when she came forward to press charges. I have no recollection of him even being in WWE in late 95. I think the Heavenly Bodies were still around at the beginning of the year, and then they disappeared. So it sounds like Tatanka may have been unfairly accused. I'm not even sure how that case was resolved, quite frankly, but it sounds like Tatanka may have been wrongfully accused, or there just wasn't enough evidence to place him at the scene as having done anything wrong. But yes, that was definitely a blight on his career, and it hurt him. And even though they brought him back at the beginning of 96, he only lasted a couple of months, and then he was gone. And we didn't see Tatanka in WWE again until 2005, during the SmackDown era of 05. I'm going to try to record my Survivor Series predictions a few days early, as I normally try to do. It's hard now because they've moved SmackDown to Friday nights. So any predictions I do on Thursday, let's say, aren't going to factor in the go-home show to the pay-per-view, which sucks. But I will try to get them done early if I can. Those would go up on YouTube. Next weekend is episode 627. That will be the final sound-off before Survivor Series, which is coming up next Sunday. And NXT TakeOver is that weekend as well. Probably not going to do a live stream for that. I'll probably just save my review for the sound-off the next day, but I could always change my mind. That's why you got to be subbed to the channel. That way, if I go live, you'll get a notification. So that's coming up, a big weekend coming up with TakeOver, Survivor Series. I'm looking forward to Dynamite. They've got a big lineup coming up on Wednesday. I will be live on YouTube for that. A lot of good shit coming up in this next 7 days. And don't forget, you can still get the new Mayor Kane book. You can pre-order it right now. It's officially coming out in about, I think, 10 days from now. You can pre-order it for free. Get your copy for free. All you need to do is sign up for an Audible trial. Audibletrial.com/Solomonster. Free for 30 days. If you cancel before 30 days, yeah, I don't like Audible, or I can't afford it. You get to keep Mayor Kane's book. And he narrates all 7 hours of audio for you. So you get to hear about his life and his career and politics and Kane and Isaac Yankem and all the shit in between. It sounds like a grand old time. I actually am looking forward to hearing from people what they think of this book. So use our link, and I will be back here for a brand new episode of the podcast, as always, with a brand new RSPW Rewind, I promise you, next Sunday. Until then, have yourselves a great week. Take care, guys.
The Solomonster sounds off.
Cesaro and Shinsuke Nakamura beat Chad Gable and Mustafa Ali. Gable walked out in that Shorty G gear to absolutely no reaction at all. He was building momentum as himself, not as Shorty G, as Chad fucking Gable, because he's that damn good. Way to go, you schmucks.
The Solomonster Sounds Off, available wherever you hear podcasts, including iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spotify, and now Pandora.
Want more content?
Visit youtube.com/thesolomonster for Sound Off extras and more. And follow The Solomonster on Twitter, @Solomonster.
Solomonster.
Solomonster.
that cigarette out.
Salamonster Sounds Off.